Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, November 4th, 2018. Election Day's Tuesday. Go vote. This is episode 1538. But don't listen to it till you vote. You voted? Okay. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career with flexible training and binge-worthy content from IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 for 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. And don't forget, if you're signing up for a personal premium or standard monthly membership, you'll also get a free 7-day trial. And by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website at wordpress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. And you get 15% off any new plan at wordpress.com/techguy. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Yes, it's time to talk tech. Computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, augmented reality, real reality, all that jazz. 8888-ASK Leo. That's my phone number, 888-827-5536. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. Or Canada. All you have to do is call that number if you're out of the country via Skype. And that'll get you in here, too, and shouldn't cost you anything. 8888-ASK-LEO, website techguylabs.com. So Apple had an event on Tuesday. Yeah, I think you know. I think you heard about that. And if you took my advice over the last few weeks and did not buy a Macintosh or an iPad, you were wise because Apple announced new Macs and new iPads. Kind of an odd announcement in Mac world. None of this was unexpected. The leaks were all true. But the Mac announcement was a little maybe disappointing. Everybody was hoping for a sub-$1,000 MacBook Air, sub-$1,000 MacBook Air. And that didn't come about. The MacBook Air, updated MacBook Air, starts at $1,199. So it's not cheap, and really, for what you get, it's maybe a little overpriced even then, and that's because it's got a 128-gig hard drive, solid-state hard drive. It's not so much. It's got 8 gigs of RAM. That's not so much. And it's got a processor no one had ever seen before from Intel. They called it an 8th-generation dual-core i5. and it took a little while for people to figure out. Finally, Intel put it on their roadmap. What it was, which is a low power, 7-watt, which is very low power. Let put this in perspective. Intel's beast of a workstation chip, which they announced about a month ago, the Xeon W is 256 watts. Now, you might say, well, Leo, these aren't light bulbs. Who cares? 7 watts, 250. But you could think of the performance of the processor kind of like a light bulb. 256-watt processor, very bright, right? Fills the room with light. 7 watts, kind of a dim, and it's kind of a dim processor. It's the Y-class processors, which are designed for mobile devices and not very fast. So this MacBook Air will be a little bit faster than the MacBook. It'll be a little bit faster than the 2-year-old MacBook Air, but not much. They put a better screen in it. Needed a better screen, a terrible screen. They are still selling the old MacBook Air, oddly. Oh, I know why, because it's $999. So there is a $1,000 MacBook Air, the old one. They also updated a 4-year-old Mac Mini, and that one is a little bit more beefy. People use that in a variety of interesting ways. They're internet service providers who have racks and racks of Mac Minis. there are movie editors, film editors who use Mac Minis to do rendering. So they've, again, racks and racks of Mac Minis. The Mac Mini is $100 more than it was last time, but hey, it's been 4 years. Probably, probably the same price, really, in $1990 or whatever. The big story, of course, the iPads. And two new iPads, an iPad Pro, they call it 11 inches. It is, both of these iPad Pros have skinny little frames. They call them bezels, right? Little skinny little frames. No room for a home button anymore. That's gone. They're going to use Face ID. Good news, the Face ID will work no matter how the iPad is oriented. So you can, in any of the four ways, and even, I guess, tilted, you could have it. It will recognize you. I like that. That's nice. You know, it's not going to change the world, but it's nice. Pretty good camera in the back, you know, the back, you know, what do they call it? The back camera. The front camera, the one that's facing you, front facing, is like the iPhone X. It's got Face ID and it's got, you know, depth sensing, and you're going to be able to do all the weird portrait stuff that Apple does. So that's kind of, but people don't buy iPads for cameras. They buy them because why do they buy iPads? I fear that most iPads people buy with great ambition. I'm going to get the iPad. I'm going to get the Apple Pencil. I'm going to draw and sketch and design. And they never do any of that. They just sit and watch Netflix. And it's a very expensive Netflix device. It really is. So the iPad Pro, that's now called the 11-inch iPad Pro, is the same size as the iPad Pro 10.5-inch, but because the screen is stretched, it's a bigger screen, half an inch bigger, diagonally. Yeah, nice. The big iPad, the 12.9-inch, which really was like the size of a pizza box, it was, I'm exaggerating, but it was so big I felt uncomfortable carrying it around. That's interesting. They didn't increase the screen size on that one. They shrunk the overall package. So now they say it's about the size of a 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. That actually, I don't know, I'll have to see. It's almost the same size screen as a MacBook Air. It's almost a 13-inch screen. So I think what's going on here is that Apple is slowly telegraphing the fact that the Mac is on its way out and the iPad is on its way in. They think of that as the future of computing. In fact, they even said that, in fact, and our benchmarks have seemed to have confirmed that it's faster. The A12X Bionic chip in it is as fast as its MacBook Pro chip in many cases. Note, by the way, very importantly, the MacBook Pro chip is an Intel chip. The A12X Bionic is an Apple chip. Apple designed, and then they outsource it to a semiconductor manufacturer in Taiwan, TSMC. That's interesting to me. It means to me Apple's getting so good at chip design that they will soon, and this has been long been the rumor, abandon Intel. Although I just heard that they're probably going to use Intel modems in their iPhone when they go to 5G in 2020. But I think their plan is, let's get off the Intel train. Intel's moving too slow for us. They point out this is the first time anybody's made a chip with this new 7-nanometer processor. Intel's stuck at 14 nanometers. Like light bulbs, the better processes have lower numbers. Unlike light bulbs. Yeah. The smaller the chip, the better. 7 billionths of a meter is what they're doing. That means it's lower power, but also more efficient and faster. So they've got a really impressive chip in there. And I honestly think that this is Apple's intent, is that we will stop buying those Macs. We don't make enough money on those Macs, Apple says. Get rid of the Macs. Buy these nice, shiny iPads and iPhones. Those are nice. Those are shiny. Make some money on those. So honestly, I feel like that's just a little bit more confirmation that that's where we're headed. And honestly, I of course, for review purposes, I bought all of them. It was a very expensive Tuesday. But I do it for you, understand. I got the big one, the little one, the medium one, the small one, the tall one. I got them all. And we'll have reviews. In fact, they're coming soon. You can order them now and go to the store and get them on Wednesday. And so by next week, I'll have at least a first look, because that's a four new devices, a Mac Mini, a MacBook Air, and a big iPad and a little iPad that I've got to review. But I will have those all for you, and I will be able to talk a little bit about them. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. You can ask me about the new Apple stuff. You can ask me about the old Apple stuff. You can ask me about anything. 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Call us. Kim Schaffer will answer the phone and take your calls. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. Let's get those calls lined up. Kim is lining them up right now, and we'll talk high-tech right after this. I think Michael Cozio's playing this for you, Kim Schaffer.
How kind.
Foxy lady. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. This is Michael Cozio, our musical director. I don't know if this is his last weekend. It's one of his last weekends.
He's training a newbie.
He's moving to the big time.
Yes, he is.
Coast to coast weekends. I feel a little bit like,
he's a brave man. I don't like overnights.
Overnights. Is that a promotion?
I would say, to me, it's not.
Could work in the middle of the day with a tech guy, a fine person, and a fine show, or go into the overnights. But he says it's a promotion, so I'm gonna accept that.
Hey, if it's more money, it's a promotion.
Oh, yeah, that's how you tell.
That's the way I tell.
Yeah, that's how you tell.
If it's overnights, it's usually a demotion, but if you're getting more money for it, go for it.
He's been doing such a great job. We're going to miss you, Michael, but Damien's taking over, and he'll be in the next. As soon as Damien says, I'm ready, put me in, coach.
Exactly.
That's when it's over for Michael. All right, Kim, you've been answering the phones.
Yeah.
Have you selected a lucky winner?
I'm ready to go to Vegas.
All right.
And then win. Jim has a solution to a previous caller. I think she was a blind woman that was trying to coordinate a wardrobe with an app.
She wanted to use the Amazon Look. Which is a kind of a goofy device. It's really intended for style suggestions. She was wondering if that would help her pick clothes. Well, maybe he's
got some suggestions.
Maybe Jim can help us.
Yes.
Thank you, Kim. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Leo. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
I'm blind, and I have two products from a company called Maxi Aids. And they provide adaptive and assistive products to blind, dyslexic, low vision, and other challenging disabilities. The one product I have, there are two products, and they're called Talking Label Wands. They're about 6 inches long, and how they work is they come with two different types of stick-on labels. One type, a set, is for clothing, and the other set or type is for anything else, only limited by your imagination. So you can stick these numbered labels on clothing or anything else, and then you record the number on the wand with whatever description you want, such as what the article of clothing is, color, style, type, and whatever you want. And you can re-record if that number should change or the article should change or whatever. And they're very reasonably priced. The one I bought was $80.
Not bad. Yeah, I see they have like a talking Bible, talking clocks, talking money identifiers, talking GPS, talking. They got everything. Maxi, MaxiAids.com. Thank you, Jim. That's awesome. Dale, Stockton, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Dale.
Leo, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. What can I do for you today?
Well, I bought an Asus laptop. It's ROG.
Yep.
And it came with Windows Home on it. And it doesn't have features that I would like to have.
Dag nabbit.
Yeah. Well, so I went and I bought the DVD for the pro version. I laid down the money and I tried to install it. And the DVD installer says, oh, you have home version. Let's install that.
No. So here's, you didn't need the DVD. In fact, you still don't need the DVD. But you have, from the DVD, you have a serial number. So that's what you really need. You can upgrade Windows in Home and Place without any, you don't have to do anything. So if you go in, let me see where it is. I think probably if you just type upgrade, you can go into the Windows settings and say, I want to upgrade. I want a better version. Or maybe if you do about this computer, you can get a better version. What features are you missing that you really – I can only think of one that I really would miss, which was BitLocker, their full disk encryption. You do have to have Pro for that.
Yeah, I do. I was interested in that, but I'd like to be able to postpone updates.
And, yep, that's another one. A lot of people want to do that. You can't postpone them forever. You shouldn't postpone them forever, but yeah, the ability to postpone a little longer is nice.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I used to use remote desktop all the time.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I would need that anymore since there's other products that work as well, I think.
Isn't that amazing that they just, and it's $100, right? It was a $100 upgrade?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a shame. I think I can understand having a Pro version that has more maybe business features, but I feel like full disk encryption should be part of every version of Windows. It's part of every version of Mac OS, part of every version of Linux. Every phone now comes with full disk encryption. And it's more important now because we're using solid state drives. And the problem with solid state drives is you can't fully erase them. Some data will always leak out. So full disk encryption, if you do that before you put anything on there, is the best way if you're going to sell a computer or, throw out the drive, the best way to protect yourself. Because once that key is removed, it's just gobbledygook everywhere on that solid state drive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm just trying to figure out. I'm looking, in the settings. There's a way to it's built in to upgrade Windows because they kind of, they want you, if you've got Windows Home, they want you to be able to upgrade it.
Okay, well, maybe you can, put it in the show notes.
Yeah, let me just see. So start, select, settings, update, and security. That's where you want to look. So if you press
security.
Yeah, if you press the Windows key and type update and security, that should get you there. And then change product key. You'll need to enter that 25-character Windows 10 Pro key that you have that you got with your DVD and then press next, and then it just downloads what it needs. Microsoft doesn't need to get a disk anymore.
Okay, so now when I do that, is that going to overwrite?
Nope. It's just going to install in place. That's the other beauty of that, right?
That is great.
Yeah.
Can I get nostalgic for just a minute with you?
Let's go back down memory lane. Yes, sir.
Okay, I remember back in the day, Tech TV doing the screensaver show, and you had an opportunity to hand out some tickets to the Las Vegas Consumer Electronics Show.
Ah, those were the days.
Yes, I got three of those tickets.
You did? Nice.
I came to see you. I got to shake your hand and my wife, and thank you, my friend. I really appreciate that.
We had a pretty nice setup, didn't we?
You did.
I remember you, Dale. Did. Now it's all coming back. Dale from Stockton, that's a name I remember well. Honestly, you think I'm joking, but I do. I don't have that many fans, Dale. I have to keep track of them.
My beard is gone now. You're a phenomenal guy.
Thank you, Dale.
Listen, I want you to know that I've been following you off and on ever since. So.
Thank you. Really appreciate
it. You guys are great.
Take care, Dale.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, everything already is on your disk for Pro, oddly enough. So really, when you enter the key, it shouldn't be installed. It takes seconds. It just basically enables stuff. It says, okay. So it's not even a new operating system. That's why you don't need the DVD. It's already on. It's already built in, baked in. 8888 Ask Leo, Leo Laporte. The Tech Guy. More calls coming up. Hey, before we go too much farther, though, I would like to mention our sponsor, IT Pro TV. They make it possible for us to bring you this podcast. IT Pro TV is a great solution for anybody who wants to get into IT, or if you're in IT already and you want to get a better job or maybe just keep skills improving all the time, and that's really what you should be doing in IT. IT Pro TV has very engaging video content. It's like a TV channel dedicated to IT professionals. Basically, that's what it is, an internet TV channel with great hosts who know their stuff, who make it fun. You can watch live Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. They've got 5 studios, so that means they've got thousands of hours, literally thousands of hours of online on-demand content that they've created in every area of technology, from all the certs, from CompTIA to Cisco to EC Council, VMware, Microsoft, Apple, but also all the technologies you'd like to know how to use. I just love IT Pro TV. You know, I just saw an MIT study that said IT occupations have grown by 19.5% between 2004 and last year. 19.5%. To put it in perspective, that's 8 times the growth rate for other jobs over that time. 800%. IT is hot. There's a job waiting for you. Get the skills you need. Get off in the certs. I'm sad to say that's how a new employer is going to judge you if you don't have the experience. But getting those certs, taking the tests, passing them, showing them that certification, that can get you in the door. And then, of course, you want to keep studying and get better and all the time. IT Pro TV's courses can be streamed live on your Roku, your Apple TV, of course, on a PC, Android and iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire TV. So you can watch it anywhere, listen to it anytime. If you've got a team, you can keep your team's skills up to date, too. They have the IT Pro TV Pro Portal, which lets you keep track of how your team's doing, assign courses to your team, create a schedule. You can see viewing time, logins, courses viewed, everything you need to know. If you want a free trial, go to itpro.tv. This is the website, itpro.tv/techguy. You can request a demo and ask about their extended trials. If you're an individual, go to itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 and you'll get 30% off. And not just for the first month or the first year, but for as long as you stay active, forever if you want. 30% off, but you got to use the code TG30. If you're signing up for a personal premium or a standard monthly membership, you'll also get a free 7-day trial so you can see if it suits you. I think it will. Such a good deal compared to going to those technical schools or even just buying the course materials. I love it. Don't forget to visit itpro.tv/techguy. Check it out. Look at the courses. This is a great career awaits you. And don't forget to use the code TG30 for 30% off. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. itpro.tv/techguy. I hear that song. Normally, Johnny joins us on Saturday, but because he's been traveling, he's joining us on a Sunday. Johnny Jett, he's our global villager. And helps us travel better with technology. And I was just telling Johnny, I told you about this before.
You never told me about this.
So it's kind of a silly thing, but there's a website called travelercollective.com, and I buy a little tiny ring. It's you know, tiny, smaller than a dime, with the name of the country and the first year I visited it for every country as I visit. And I've got a pretty full ring of these. And what's nice is, you know, it's like $7.50 per ring. But what's nice is some of that money goes to help other people travel. So the Traveler Collective, they give people grants to travel in other places. So it's really cool.
$7.50
per ring. But now remember, you got to get one for every country, right?
Yes,
it could add up, Johnny. It could add up. You've been around. How many countries do you know?
I've been close to 100. So.
Oh, you're gonna have a big ring.
I'm gonna have a big bill.
And a big bill. But it's I don't know. I have it. I keep it on my backpack, my traveling bag, and it's just kind of nice.
Do you spell it. Spell it with two L's, traveler, or.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, TRAVELLER. Collective.
It's like two L's.
Travelercollective.com. A ring for every place you've visited. And they kind of stamp them out by hand. They're in Vancouver. It's kind of fun. I just like the idea of commemorating it. And the fun thing is when you go to a new country, one you've never been before, as I did this year to Malta, Morocco, and Portugal, I get to add rings.
And do you have a map as well that you put a pin in?
That's a good idea. You do that, don't you?
I do that for sure.
I like that. I like that idea.
And I keep a lot. Actually, this is a good product. a lot of airlines, actually not a lot, but American Airlines and British Airways for sure, they have little aviation journals for kids. So
that's a neat idea.
Jack's first flight, the flight attendants came and handed us this book, and I was like, this is awesome. So ever since then, we've had the pilot, no matter what airline we're flying, log all of his information. So how many miles, where the destinations are from, the date, the signatures of the pilots, any notes.
Oh, man, I wish I'd been doing that my whole life.
Awesome. So he has actually he's on his fourth book right now. So yeah,
I think probably stopped. If you did it as an adult, Captain, can I get you to sign my book? I don't know if they'd do that.
Yeah, I think we'll stop when he's 18.
Captain, I want my wings, and I'd like you to sign my book, please. No, I bet you they don't take that's, you know, they go, kid, get out of here. But if you're little,
they like it. Love kids. You know, there's a pilot shortage. I actually just had a conversation with a pilot the other day. That he when he found out that Jack dressed up as a pilot for Halloween, he was like, oh my God, I got to send him a plane. He worked for Aer Lingus. And this guy, he's telling how in just a few years ago, if a pilot was flying for one of the regional jets, they were making, I think, $12 or $19 an hour, something ridiculous. And now, because of this pilot shortage, those pilots are now making close to $80,000 just for the regional jets. So there's a huge pilot shortage right now worldwide. So this is a great time. And the guy is like, I'm 50 years old. I can get a job right now for making at least $180 or something.
Wow.
So if there's any
you've learned to pilots, fly.
This is
well, it used to be right. They'd get them from the military a lot, right? And I think and that's kind of dried up. So
that's what he was saying.
Nice.
So,
yeah.
That's my little two tips right there. But actually, speaking of an airline, Alaska Airlines, I forgot to mention this about a month ago almost. I've had it in my notes since then that you can now text Alaska Airlines for if you have any questions instead of logging on or sitting on the phone for what seems like forever. So, you know, you can find out what the flight delays, any schedule changes, or if you have, you know, any animal service animal requests, seat assignments, upgrades, you can text them now. And the text number is 82008, which I think is really helpful. What they can't do, though, is help you make new reservations or if you want to cancel your flight, you're going to have to call or even paid seat upgrades. But, you know, if you're in a bind, this is another avenue, because I always say, like, if your flight's delayed, you know, and you're in the airport or if it's canceled, you want to make sure you make a beeline to an agent. If there's an empty one at an empty gate or a vacant one, or go to the airline club. And while you're in line, you get on the phone. But now you can take to text with Alaska. And also, I always tweet the airline, too. Some airlines, like American Airlines, are really good at responding, although, you know, their powers are limited.
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, so that's a cool little tip for Alaska Airlines. And then I have a website for you. We still got some time. Yes,
you bet. A couple of minutes, yeah.
So a lot of people always ask me, when should I buy my flight? And, you know,
always want to know that, because, you know, I plan ahead, so I could buy it 6 months ahead of time. I think that's the longest, right? They don't make them available for till 6 months.
No, 330 days.
300, not even that long. Okay, 330 days. That's 10 months. Okay, good.
So and that's usually when you want to look for your frequent flyer miles, by the way. That's when they load it, or at the very last minute is when you want to start using your miles. But let's say this is not going to help you for last minute fares, but if you're just planning far in advance, Kayak has a flight hacker guide out there. I'll tweet it because the URL is long, but it'll tell you historically what the cheapest times to buy your flights are, what months are the best months to go for that particular destination. And there's about 40 or 50 destinations in there, all the major cities. So I put in LA to New York, and I was actually kind of surprised that they said the cheapest was October at $303 round trip. And November was the most expensive, which is $379. And actually,
interesting.
But it all depends on when you buy. You don't want to buy your flights too early. You definitely don't want to buy them too early because the airline has no incentive to discount them.
There's also not a hard and fast rule because everything's so computerized now. And it's totally based on not only historic patterns, but what's happening right now. And they're constant. Those prices, that'll change every day, right?
Multiple times a day. It depends on the airline, but most of them will change multiple times a day. So it really depends. So what I recommend people doing is set a fare alert. Google Flights does a great job at setting a fare alert. YAPTA. With YAPTA, YAPTA.com, you can put in what price you want to pay, which route you want to go, and the date. And if it drops below that, they'll email you.
Yeah, that's what you need. That's Google what flights, you need.
You know, if there's going to be a price change, either increase or decrease. And I monitor all kinds of flights. Actually, I'm going, my dad's big birthday is coming up in a couple of weeks, and we're flying around Thanksgiving. It's $1,000 to go from L.A. to New York over Thanksgiving. But, and I'm going back to New York 2 weeks later, and it's $172.
Wow.
Round trip for the same flight. So you really want to pick your days wisely. You know, notoriously, the week after Thanksgiving is a great time to travel, which is a prime example. It's so cheap to fly to New York that week.
Because everybody traveled the week before for Thanksgiving, exactly. And they want to stay home now.
And same thing with New Year's. New Year's is even better. The week after New Year's is a fantastic time to travel.
Wow. This is fascinating. So what's the site that you use to figure this out?
So this is Kayak's 2018 Flight Hacker Guide. I will put it in the chat room right now, and I'll tweet it.
And we'll put it in the show notes. And of course, if you follow Johnny Jet on Twitter, that's the best place to see all that stuff.
Or type in Kayak 2018 Flight Hacker Guide.
Johnny Jet on Twitter and your website, johnnyjet.com. Instagram, yep. Johnny Jet.
See got pictures. It. One T, I'm not related to Joan.
There's only one T. He's not related to Joan. Thank you, Johnny. We'll talk again next week. I was going to say safe travels, but he's home. Stay home. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Are you staying home for a little while?
Yeah. I've been invited on a few inaugural flights. I got invited to go on the inaugural Kenya Airways flight from JFK to Nairobi. First time ever. Wow. That they're doing that flight. I turned that down. And then also 2 nights ago, I was supposed to fly to Singapore on that new, brand new inaugural LA-Singapore flight.
Man, Zach's going to start beating you. You keep turning these things down. You got to go.
Zach can keep traveling. He doesn't have a little guy.
Zach goes on all of them.
He does. I like to follow Zach, but you know what? It's just, I want to be with my boy.
I feel like Zach he spends way too much time in the air. Like he must fly almost, we're talking about the points guy, right?
Well, he's not the points guy.
He's not the points guy. He works for the points guy.
Okay. But he does travel more.
See, the points guy is smart. The points guy stays home, makes all the money, and Zach has to ride on all the airplanes.
The points guy does travel too, but actually one of my buddies, actually two of my friends, Ramsey and this guy named Lucky, he has a site. He literally is out of his mind. He flew 7 red eyes in a row. And I'm not talking short red eyes. I'm talking D.C., Abu Dhabi, then to...
some people, I guess, like being on an airplane.
Every night of the week, he was on a different red eye. You could not pay me. And these are long-haul red eyes.
It's exhausting. He should wear a little rad badge that shows how much radiation he's accumulating up there in the sky.
It's too much.
The chat room gave me another place. This might be kind of cool for Natalie. That does bracelets with the countries you've been to, so that's kind of cool too. That's elcaminobracelets.com.
Okay,
elcaminobracelets.com. So these, see, Lisa, I showed Lisa my ring. She said, "Well, if they were sterling silver, maybe, but they're not. They're like steel. These are probably steel as well. They can't be silver. They're not expensive enough. But I think it's kind of neat because you can get countries, you can get cities." You can get oceans, you can get regions, so you could like break it up. But you know what? There's no way you're going to get enough of a bracelet to get all your countries on there.
Yeah.
This is for lightweight travelers.
Well, you know what? I always try to tell people, trying to go to one new country a year.
I try to do that.
To see the world. Yeah. And it will make a big difference because, as corny as it sounds, and I've said this before, I don't know if it was here, but the more people travel, the less prejudices there will be in the world.
So, and Lisa and I both agree with you 100%. I'm going to get to every year, you're right, at least one. I think 3 new countries this 2019. Israel, Jordan, and one more.
That's next year, right?
Or 2019, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and this year I got 3 new countries too. So, yeah, if I keep that up.
I didn't travel. The first time I went out of the country besides Canada and Mexico, I was 23. I went to Hong Kong.
Yeah. But the problem is it's hard to add new countries after a while. I keep going back to France.
Yeah, well, just explore, especially when you're out.
Yeah.
When you're in Europe.
That's what I want to do. I don't mind going back.
So many countries.
Yeah. We didn't get enough time in Barcelona. We didn't get enough time in Tokyo. I want to see more. Yeah. Hey, Johnny, have a good one.
Hey, you too. Thanks for having
me. Take care. Always a pleasure. Love to the family. Bye-bye. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Fred on the line. Next call.
Hi.
Hi, Fred. Welcome.
Hi. You remember me from last week?
Of course I do, Fred.
Low vision.
Yes.
I want to call to thank you immensely. I've received so many emails with people not knowing about things that were available, and I started a blog.
That's great. Fred gave his email last week, and so people responded because he wanted to help people who have low vision to find stuff. That's awesome.
Right, and I got so many nice letters that people made me feel like I was an angel. I'm not an angel. I was just trying to help people, and they were really excited about how vibrant and excited I was about what I did.
Well,
and I am.
You're great. You're awesome.
I called to thank you so much for allowing me to put my email on and have those people contact me, and they can still contact me whenever they feel like it. I just spoke to a minister. I just spoke to somebody in Montreal.
Wow.
And they call me, and it's been really exciting with the technology today that's available with all these devices. And by the way, you were mentioned you're going to go to Jordan and Israel.
Yeah.
I've been in Jordan and Israel. I worked in Saudi Arabia for 5 years, and I did the pipeline trip across the country to Jordan. I went to be sure to go to Jerash and Petra.
It's been a lifetime dream to go. I don't know if I'll get to Jerash, but a lifetime dream to go to Petra, and I am absolutely going to Petra. Yeah.
You'll be excited. I went there and spent time, and I had to have an insert put in my passport because I worked in Saudi and I went to Israel.
They don't like you going back and forth like that, do they?
No, not at all. Not when I worked there. And I was one of the few Jewish people to work in Saudi. My last name is not Jewish, so they allowed me to stay.
Isn't that terrible? For five years
I worked
there
in hospitals.
Shocking.
Yeah, it is shocking, really. All right, I just wanted to
give us the email address again, Fred.
That's drugkingfred@gmail.com.
No, I guess I better explain. Fred is not a drug king. He's a retired pharmacist. drugkingfred@gmail.com. And what kind of, you want to help people with low vision with technology. Is that it?
And also resources where they can contact various people and places. I have all that available.
That is so, so awesome. You're also on Twitter, Drug King Fred on Twitter.
That's correct.
And
I don't use Twitter, though. I don't use any of those media things anymore. No. I cut loose from all of them.
Good man, Fred.
I'm about ready to create a blog with a friend so I can put all that information there and people can give me information also.
I think that's the best thing to do because then A, you control it as opposed to Facebook and Twitter where they control it. And B, it's a resource. And then people Google it. They're going to find that. And it's going to stay there forever. And it's a really great way, I think, to share the knowledge that you have with the world.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
I'm so happy
what you did in allowing. And the people are very excited. I've been still getting things a week later. They evidently go onto your chat site and find the information there.
That's right. We got a blog, too. Yeah.
What episode is this, 1538?
This is 1538. And you were on which one?
1536.
Okay, so people can go to techguylabs.com and get the whole story. In fact, they can even watch or listen to your call from back then. All they have to do is go to that episode, 1536.
Yeah, that's what I'm passing on to friends that want to hear it. But some of the emails I got made me tear in my eyes.
Fred.
Some of the stories that people told me, I couldn't believe it. And they said they had changed their whole outlook on life, that I'm able to do these things. People with multiple sclerosis, people with eye problems. It's a wonderful feeling, Leo. We don't have enough people in the world. There are a lot of good people. They're not all bad like you hear on radio.
I agree. You watch the news and you start to think, man, this place is going to hell in the handbasket. But it isn't, is it?
Yeah.
There's good people like Drug King Fred out there. Thank goodness.
They're talking about civil war in this country.
I know.
Crazy.
I know.
Which is It's nutty.
Hey, Fred.
All right.
This is why I am still bullish on the internet. As many problems as the internet causes, in the long run, I think it does more good. And this is a perfect example. Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, for an 87-year-old, it's done miracles for me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You're great. Thank you
so
Fred.
Much, Leo.
Have a wonderful
enjoy
day. It's good to hear from you. You too. Maybe you should get a better email address. Don't call the blog Drug King Fred's blog. Maybe. Why not, right? You don't forget it. He's a pharmacist. He's not a pusher man. Line 3, Al in Rosenberg, Oregon. Hello, Al.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm great. How are you, Al?
I'm doing just fine. I'm staying out of trouble.
You set the clocks back and everything. You're all set on time, I guess.
I got that all handled.
Yeah. Changed your smoke alarm batteries too, right?
Yep, it all at once.
Oh, you see, I could tell you were a responsible citizen. What can I do for you, Al?
Okay, here's the deal. I have an LG 50-inch TV, 4K, and it has a digital audio out.
Yes.
I bought a digital audio converter because I have a Pioneer VSX D35, and it only has a coax in for the AC3. You know, for the Okay.
So what is the Pioneer? Is that an amp? What is that?
That's an amplifier, yeah. Okay. It was the old tuner. It was one of the first.
And it's an analog. It comes from the analog days prior to digital audio. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So, yeah, you might have analog out of that TV. Sometimes they do. Sometimes it's just a headphone jack or it's that those red and white RCA connectors.
Right. It has none of those.
Only optical.
And I bought an optical converter.
Good.
Okay. I hooked it to my Sony and it works. I have a Sony Blu-ray player and I hook that into it and everything works fine.
Nice.
When I unplug it from the Sony and plug it into the TV, I get no sound.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you're saying you take it out, the optical converter, you take it off the TV and you put it into the Blu-ray player?
No. I put it from the optical TV into the...
into the amp.
Digital converter.
Yeah, into the amp.
And then into the amp with the coax.
Yeah, but what are you doing that makes it not work?
I have no idea, because I even had a technician from LG come out and look at it, and he thought maybe it was the main board. So he replaced the main board, and it still doesn't work.
I'm still trying to visualize what's going on here. So I understand that you have it coming of the optical add-on, the LG TV, into an optical, a digital converter. To analog converter that goes into your Pioneer amp. I understand that. But you said you do something that makes it stop working. What is that?
Well, when I plug it into my Sony Blu-ray player.
Plug what into your Sony Blu-ray player? What are you taking and plugging into your Sony Blu-ray player?
I'm taking the cable out of the LG.
That's what I asked. So you're taking it from the TV and putting it in the Blu-ray player.
No. I'm disconnecting I only have one thing. I can't splice the wires or anything. So what I can do is to check to see that the converter and everything was working. I plug the cable into my Sony and everything works. When I unplug
I don't have enough. There's not enough coffee yet for me to understand this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're still there?
Yeah. Hold on. I had to take a break. So, the network wants the news. Okay. I'm going to make a diagram. So LG TV, this has optical out. It goes into, and you have this simple optical converter that takes digital and converts it to analog for the Pioneer amp.
Correct.
I understand that. So then we call that a DAC, a digital to analog converter. Now, you're taking the TV's output and you're putting it into your Blu-ray player?
No.
You're unplugging it from your TV?
And plug it into my Blu-ray player.
And plugging into your Blu-ray player. Okay. And why are you doing that?
Well, I'm just to check to see if the box is working. Okay, so then when I disconnect it from my Sony Blu-ray player and plug it into my TV, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Can you get it to work again, or has it never worked again since?
No, I plug it back into the Sony Blu-ray player, and it works fine.
Okay, but now it's stopped working entirely with the LG TV.
It won't work with. It never worked with the LG TV.
Oh, it never worked with the LG. Never, ever.
Never, ever. That's right.
So you've got this DAC that works fine with the Blu-ray player, but doesn't work with the LG TV.
Right.
Got it.
Okay, you got through my confusion.
I got it. So the DAC works with the Blu-ray player. And what is the output on the Blu-ray player look like? Is it with optical, you have a variety of different output connectors. Is it one of those looks like a train tunnel that's got a little hatch that you plug into it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And on the DAC, who makes the DAC?
Well, you know, it doesn't really have a name.
Okay.
It says digital audio converter.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So this is interesting because the TV and the blue. So there may be you may be getting different things out of the TV and the Blu-ray player. So that's what I'm interested in here. And it might be that the capabilities of the DAC are limited and can't handle. So it never worked with the LG. You never were able to get any audio out of the LG doing it that way.
No.
Okay.
No.
So one thing I'm surprised the LG people didn't suggest this. Maybe they did. You probably need to go to the menu on the LG TV and disable the speakers and say, I'm going to be using external speakers.
I had the guy from LG come out and look at the TV, and he thought it was in the main board.
But did you go, you know, sometimes these guys are not as bright as they look. Or sometimes they're exactly as bright as they look, which is not at all.
Well, he had a special remote control.
Yeah, he had that. Yeah, they do. They give him a special remote. But you, with your remote, can choose the speaker output on the TV. Have you ever done that?
Yes, we have.
So you've chosen external speakers?
Correct.
Okay. When you choose internal speakers, you hear audio on the TV. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. The other possibility is that the TV and the Blu-ray are outputting different forms, and your DAC, you should look in the specs of the DAC, whether it requires, there are different kinds. There's encoded audio, Dolby encoded audio, that may be coming out of the player or the TV, and then there's PCM, which is unencoded bitstream audio.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the technical data on the DAC. It says it uses 24-bit audio, DSP 996 KHZ digital receivers, 24-bit ADC, supports all S/PDIF digital audio transmission.
I suspect that the transmission that your Blu-ray player is sending PCM, unencoded Dolby Digital, and your TV is sending encoded Dolby Digital, or vice versa. So look again. This is in your LG menu. You want to look at the kind of output that the TV. You want I think you want PCM.
Yeah, I've tried all of that stuff. I believe me, I've played with this. So, you know, I know enough to be real dangerous.
Yeah. So my theory is that the DAC's working fine, and it could be the technician is right and the TV's broken, so what he's saying is, yeah, you're not getting any digital audio out of that digital audio port, which is possible, and if that's the case, yeah, it won't work. But I think.
He replaced the main board, and the red light is on.
So you can see light coming out of that Toslink port.
Correct.
Okay, that's a good sign, I guess. I mean, if no light's not a good sign. Was there no light before?
Nope, there was light on it before.
Yes. I never assumed that the technician knew what he was doing. You might have noticed that.
Yes.
I mean, often they do, but one would assume they do, but there's a mistake to assume they do because often. They just don't. So, you know, so there's several possibilities here. It is possible that the TV's broken. Doesn't sound like it. Unfortunately, testing it means you'd have to get a different device that can handle digital audio out to see right. if you're getting digital audio out of it. And that's kind of prohibitively expensive.
I bought them on eBay and I can't remember. They were
well, that's the problem. And that's the other possibility that this is a junky DAC. It's weird that it works with the Blu-ray. Honestly, the two possibilities that strike me most likely are either the TV's broken, that seems unlikely, or it's outputting something that the DAC can't understand. The Blu-ray outputs something the DAC could understand. So what you want to do is, in both cases, look at what the Blu-ray's outputting to digital audio. Is it encoded? Is it not? Is it, you know, figure out what that stream is and duplicate it from the LG. Do you get what I'm saying? There are different. Just because it's optical out doesn't mean it's the same. There's different kinds of optical out. There's a pure bit stream. There's an encoded bit stream. You want to make sure that, and the DAC may not understand everything. So you want to make sure that you do know the DAC understands the Blu-ray. So what you want to do is make sure that the TV's outputting the same exact kind of optical audio that the Blu-ray is. You see what I'm saying? That's my only advice. If it doesn't work, if they're both outputting, say, let's say a pure PCM bit stream, but the DAC works with the TV, doesn't work with the TV, but does work with the Blu-ray, then it probably is a TV. Not definitely. So you know that's the trick, is to figure out. And don't forget to change your smoke detector battery. Thank you very much. I got to run. I don't know if I've helped. Chat room is commenting over my shoulder, and I think they concur that this is probably what's going on. You could, you know, the reason it's got optical out of that TV is most TV optical out goes into a sound bar, which most sound bars take an optical out. So the other thing you could try is just beg, borrow, or steal a sound bar that takes optical audio and see if you can hear your TV. That would be the way to diagnose that. Now I must run.
Thank you.
I don't think I was much help, Al, but I did the best I could with what I have. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to play our game, our tech guy show game, where you call, ask me questions, I act befuddled, and then try to give you the answer. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. If you're just joining us, good morning. Forgot to set your clock back, didn't you? So I hope you set it back. I am not a fan. I know I'm not alone in this. Of changing the time twice a year. We know it's bad for people. It's bad for your sleep. Heart attacks on the day after the time change go up. Car accidents tomorrow on Monday when people go to work will go up. We are very sensitive, you know, our circadian rhythms, we're very sensitive to time changes and to this time's not so bad because you get an extra hour, right? It's worse when we change to daylight saving time and you lose an hour. So you have my sympathy, and I just hope that we can get rid of this insanity. Nobody likes it. It doesn't save energy. We know that. The farmers don't, you know, they always said, well, it's for the farmers. No, it's not. Farmers don't. Believe me, they're getting up to milk the cow. Dark or light, doesn't matter. It's probably dark no matter what. We don't need to do it. And it's a relatively modern thing, the history of daylight saving time. It's not like we've been doing this forever and ever and ever. Was it Ben Franklin who first thought the idea up? I think it was. In any event, it didn't really take off until World War II. And it wasn't a national policy until, I think, the 50s. There's a great Wikipedia article on daylight saving time. And the irony is it reduces lighting costs, but increases total energy consumption. Maybe do you think it's the light bulb industry? I don't know. It's just not a... Stop the insanity. 8888-ASK. Here in California, we have a ballot measure we'll be voting on Tuesday, Proposition 7, that is... Sounds on the face of it, it'd be a good idea. It says, from now on, California will just stay on daylight saving time, which is never change. I like the never change part, but you can't stay on daylight saving time without the federal government saying, yeah, you can change your time zone, because that's what you're doing. You cannot go to daylight saving time. Many states do that. Well, several. Hawaii, right? Arizona, Alaska, parts of Indiana. You can do that. You don't need federal approval for that. But for some reason, this ballot proposition is doing the opposite. They're saying, well, we don't want to go back to standard time. We want to stay in saving time. I just don't want to change. Whatever it is, let's figure out what time it is and keep it. It's too complicated. 8888-ASK-LEO. Stephen in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Now, are you part of Indiana where they change or not?
They made us change a few years ago, so now we're subject to the daylight saving time.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So sorry. It's very confusing.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's worse for you guys. You're not used to it. What can I do for you today?
Well, I have a problem that actually could have been a good lead-in for the Carbonite ad.
Uh-oh. I don't like hearing that.
Yep. My sister, she's got a MacBook Pro that's about vintage from 2010 or 2011, and its hard drive is failing. And she hadn't been backing this thing up ever, but she hardly ever used it. But then I found out that my niece had been saving all of her baby pictures to this computer.
Oh!
Yes. And so I configured an external hard drive and loaded the Apple software onto it so it could boot off that external drive.
Smart. Good. Yeah.
To try running the disk utility.
Yep.
And the disk utility, when it looked at that internal drive, it said that it could not repair it, and it urged us to back up that data.
A little late, disk utility. Could have mentioned that earlier.
Right. I couldn't do so successfully.
So, yeah, I mean, the Apple disk utility is not the last word in all of this, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good news that it can see the drive. You know, the worst case scenario is that the drive controller or something's gone wrong with the drive itself, and then it wouldn't even show up. You wouldn't be able to mount it. You are able to mount it. In fact, you were able to run the disk utility on it. That's a very that's encouraging.
Right.
What it probably means is that the drive – it's a couple of possibilities. The drive isn't a hardware failure. It's messed up. It somehow got messed up. It could be that, you know, it could be the drive itself is starting to fail, like it's not able to record data reliably. It could be that something happened. The machine was unplugged by accident during the middle of a write and stuff got spewed all over it. So now you need some higher-end tools. Unfortunately, unlike the Windows world, in the Mac world, there are not a lot of good disk utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are fairly pricey. Unfortunately, Apple's disk utility is not on that list. There's one that's been around forever called Disk Warrior. Let's see if I can find one that's relatively free. Go ahead.
My sister, she took it to a local shop. We don't have an Apple store locally, but I think they would actually send the machine out if they were to tackle this.
Yeah.
And the estimate they gave her was like $250.
Yeah, but unfortunately, the really bad news is the more people mess with it, the less likely it's recoverable.
Right.
So, you know, if you wanted to do this perfectly, the first thing you would do is image the drive, hope that image got enough of the data that you could work on it, because you don't want to mess with the drive itself. Generally, you know, often it's the case you have one chance to recover the drive. So I'm not encouraged by the idea of sending it out. However, if they know drive recovery, the truth is you don't need to send the Mac out. You could take the drive out. Is it iMac?
MacBook Pro.
That's a MacBook Pro. Depending on the vintage, you said 2011, I think you could open that up and take out the drive, literally just take it out. And then you can work on it with PC tools as well as Mac tools. Because it's a, I'm pretty sure. I know 2015 I could do that. So 2011 for sure. There's just a bunch of screws on the bottom. If you take them off, you need a special head, Torx head to do that. If you take them off, you can open it up and you'll see it's a standard laptop drive in there. So at that point, you can take it out and start running some better tools. I mean, the Disk Warrior and Tech Tool Pro are the kind of grandfather, you know, disk recovery utilities for Mac. I don't think they're as good. They run on a Mac, but see, if you can take it out of the Mac, you can just put it in a PC and run something on it from a PC.
Okay.
So there's a couple of different things I would try. If you could take it out, you put it in an enclosure, or you can go to Newer Tech and buy. They have a short-time use USB adapter that you can plug into a bare-bones drive and turn it into a USB drive. Then you could run maybe my friend Steve Gibson's SpinRite against it. That would detect if there's just sectors that are they're getting bad that can't be written to. That's a very nice low-level tool to run that doesn't care about the file system. And it's handy because it can recover it without loss of data, and it doesn't really impinge on anything else. So you can run that first. I usually do that. SpinRite is from GRC.com. It's $90, though. And then if that doesn't help, I bet it will, but if that doesn't help, then you can start using higher-end tools. Start working your way up. The PC tool is not going to recognize the hierarchical file system that the Macintosh uses, so you have to use stuff that operates at below the file system level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there are a lot of tools like Recova that might help. It is. It's going. Are you an expert in this kind of stuff?
I'm very good at Windows machines, but okay. not so much with Apple.
You now understand what the issue is. Just like this happens on Windows machines, right? There's lots of tools you can run. There's different levels that the failure could have occurred. If you erase files by accident, there's unerase utilities because the data is never gone. But those I have to understand the file system. So Windows unerase or DOS unerase utilities don't work with Mac and vice versa. But that's the high level stuff. Lower level stuff like SpinRite, it's a physical drive, right? It's a spinning drive. It's not an SSD.
Yes.
Yeah. SpinRite would be the first thing I'd run on that. I think probably you're going to get your data back if you run SpinRite on it. So take it out, put it in a USB enclosure, or better yet, get a mount for a laptop drive for your PC, if you have a tower PC, put it in there, run SpinRite on it. It might take a while. Chances are good you're going to get that back.
Okay. I noticed that at a local store, too, that the price of SSDs had come down, like, really significantly.
Absolutely. Should replace. When you put it back, put an SSD in for sure.
Well, what about if I pop this thing open and put the failing drive into that external enclosure, went ahead and installed an SSD and put Mac OS on there?
Yep.
And then used, like I noticed that Disk Warrior, it comes with a bootable flash drive, not USB.
Right. Yes, you have to do that because to do real file recovery, you can't be running on the drive that's you're recovering. You know all that from Windows. It's just that Disk Warrior and Tech Tool are older, and I don't think as sophisticated as – there's, ironically, a ton of stuff for Windows to do this. There's only a handful of things that do it on the Mac.
Yeah, I'm noticing that.
And they're not as good, honestly. But you will – if it's just a file – it's like if it accidentally got corrupted, the file system, you have to use a Mac – aware program because it's the only thing that could understand what's going on at that level.
Right.
Low level, anything will work. SpinRite doesn't care what the file system is. It looks at it sector by sector.
Okay.
All right.
Hey, excellent.
Hey,
well, thank you very much.
Have fun. Good luck. And next time, teach her to back up.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Thank you very much, Miguel.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call. I hope you hear these calls and you go, yeah, I don't want to do that. It's so much cheaper to make sure you have good backups of your data and it's reliable. And if you don't, that's your future right there. What you just heard, your poor cousin has to come over and suffer. You better make him a nice dinner. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Taking a break here, and when we come back, more of your calls, 8888 Ask Leo. Our website, free, no sign up, use it anytime, techguylabs.com. Hey, our show today brought to you by my blog host. We talked yesterday, somebody was stuck on the old school, you know, hosting, and she was hand coding her website in HTML using a coffee, whatever that coffee program was. And I just said, you know, you really ought to go to WordPress.com. This is the modern way to have a website, whether you're a business, a blog, a personal site. My site, LeoLaporte.com, is on WordPress.com. In fact, I just got the little badge on my WordPress app. I've been a WordPress.com subscriber and member and a blogger for 12 years now. That's practically as long as I've been blogging. Once I found WordPress, I said, I'm done. This is it. Turn your vision into reality. Launch your website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. It's hassle-free. WordPress takes care of the hosting, the security, the software updates, everything. All you have to do is post stuff. In fact, now that I've gotten rid of all the social media, I post more at WordPress. That's where my stuff lives because I control it. I can upload videos, audio, pictures. I can import and export. They live on the WordPress host, but they're mine. It's my site, my home, my content, and I really like that. I don't want Mark Zuckerberg to control my content or Jack Dorsey or Larry Page or anybody else. I want my site, and that's really the way it ought to be for you. Everybody needs a website so that when people Google your name, that's what they find. You control it. Go to WordPress.com. You can choose from hundreds of designs so they'll match your aesthetic, your vision, your brand. You don't need any design experience. You can do it. Let them do all the hard work. Grow your audience. Reach new customers with built-in search engine optimization, social media features like linking, which is great. Means your customers or readers can share your site on their Facebook and Twitter and build your audience. Great marketing tools. Of course, 24/7 support from a great support team. I love WordPress. In fact, I'm not alone because, get this, 32% of all the websites in the world, almost a third, run on WordPress. Okay, that's a pretty good testimonial. Right now, get 15% off any new plan purchase at WordPress.com/TechGuy. WordPress.com/TechGuy. Create your new website. Everybody ought to have one. And you know, if you've got teenagers, get them set up with their domain name and their website. Get them, you know, proactively putting their name and reputation out there so that somebody else doesn't. You know what I'm saying? Let them own it. WordPress.com/TechGuy. Thank you, WordPress. 12 years. It's a long time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Line one, Ron, Westminster, California. Hello, Ron.
Hey, Leo. Boy, I've had so much enjoyment listening to your programs, but this is the first time I've had the pleasure to call you because I got a problem.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry you have a problem, but I'm glad to meet you.
Okay, well, and just before I get into it, I wanted to just, you know, because you mentioned daylight savings time, you've probably seen this cartoon. It's a picture of an Indian chief, and the caption says, "Only white man believes he can cut 1 inch off the top of a blanket, sew it on the bottom, think he has a longer blanket."
Yes, I'm afraid that's what we're doing, isn't it? That's exactly what we're doing.
Take
it in the spring and lose it in the fall.
A couple of years ago, I bought a Western Digital MyPassport Ultra. It's a solid-state 1 terabyte drive.
Yeah. Boy, you know, I'm going to say it right up front. Stop. Nobody, stop. Don't buy these. Go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm going to give them all the reasons why not.
Yeah, you know, Western Digital, which makes hard drives, has been putting out all of these, like, solutions, like the MyBook and the Passport and so forth. And I hear more people call like you with problems with them. So I have a hard time recommending it. What's happened to you?
Well, you're kind of my last resort before I follow these other directions. Anyway, okay. I've got an older PC that's got XP on it. I copied some files onto it, and then I used it for my newer Dell laptop that's running Windows 10,
yep.
And I did a backup onto it. Well, after I did that, I just let it sit. I should have been doing backups, but I just let it sit and do nothing for over a year.
Yeah.
Now I get in there, and it's listed in the device manager. if I go down to the part where, you know, it gives you a chance to safely remove the device, it shows it listed there, but I can't access it on the computer. And yeah. So
let me just talk a little bit about what's going on here. A USB drive, there's a couple of components to this. One is the USB part, and that's what your computer is seeing. It's saying, yes, you have a USB device attached. But that doesn't guarantee that it can read the data. It just means I see a USB device.
Okay.
So, yeah, I can see it. That's good. I mean, if it couldn't see it, well, then it'd be even worse. It would mean that the USB enclosure that drive is in is non-functioning. It sounds like USB enclosure is functioning, just not the drive.
Well, here's what happens. I go to disk management. I see all of the usual things. And in disk management, you know, it shows a disco, which is a partition. You know, I guess it's the back.
So you see the drive in the disk manager.
Well, here's what I see. I see disk O, and it's got a complete description of it. And that's the, like, I think the, you know, the reboot stuff if you get into problems. But down below, it says disk 1, unknown, not initialized.
Yeah.
So then Western Digital had me send a screenshot of this screen, and they ended up writing me back and saying, well, looks to me like it's toast, and because it's out of warranty, you might want to go out and find some data recovery service.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, that was helpful.
Oh, my God.
That was helpful. So, again, this is just one more reason to back up your data on more than one place, more than one thing. You only have, this is the only copy you have of this stuff. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. Well, I've got it on the two computers. And the two computers, even the old one with XP, thankfully it still runs also.
Okay, so you haven't lost any data. You just want this drive to get better?
Well, if there was a way other than them telling me it's toast.
But again, there's nothing on the drive you absolutely have to have.
That's correct. I can still retrieve it from the two.
So that's good. I mean, worst case scenario, you're out of drive. Drives do die. I mean, from every manufacturer, it doesn't really matter. Generally, what happens with hard drives, spinning hard drives, it's not true of SSDs, but spinning hard drives, which that one is, they will either die right away, infant mortality. They'll die in the first few weeks or months. Because there's some manufacturer defect. If a drive survives, then usually, and this is based on data from IBM, Google, and others who use thousands of hard drives, usually it will survive a couple of years, and then they all start dying at the rate of about 10% a year forever. Just they wear out. So it could be worn out. If there's nothing you need on it, I think just, you know, say it's time for another drive. You could try taking it out of the USB enclosure and rescuing it, but if it's rescued, you still don't trust it, right? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So in other words, it's not, you could save it maybe, but it would then forever be suspect, right?
Yeah. Like, I think at least if I was able to save it, I'd copy all the data off into a file on my computer, and then it'd make it all a little easier when I went out and got another one.
Okay. Yeah, right, because you have this kind of nice, discrete backup. You've tried it on both machines. Both machines get the same result.
Well, I got to be honest with you. No, I have not tried it in the XP machine yet.
Since the XP machine's still around and working, I would try it just to make sure it's not something specific to that new machine.
Okay.
But, you know, just because it can see the USB controller doesn't mean it can read the data on the drive. And there's lots of reasons that drive could look uninitialized. It could be all the data is there. It's exactly what I was talking about the last guy about. It could be all that data is there, and it just, you know, the file allocation table or the table of contents is missing, or the partition information is missing. But if the data is all there, it's possible to recover it. It won't be as convenient to use as it would be if you could just see the folder. You know, you may have to run some recovery software on it. The data itself may not be fully reliable. Some parts of it may be mangled, things like that. So,
well, I noticed one other thing. You know, I've said it says disk 1 unknown, not initialized. If I right click on it, it says initialized disk. Is that something?
No. If you do that, you could do that. It might be that this then works fine, but all your data is gone.
Oh.
So, okay, well, which is more important, the data on the disk or the disk?
Oh, no.
Don't initialize it yet. And even, again, though, even if you initialized it, I no longer trust that drive because it failed on you, right? It's not even, you know.
And it failed just sitting. I mean, I never dropped it. It's just that it sat for a year not being used.
Well, that can happen. Yeah.
Drive.
That can happen. I mean, that's less likely than, you know, wearing out from use, but it can happen. There are certainly recovery programs. The problem with the USB drive is the USB drive hides details of the drive. The USB interface hides details of the drive from the computer. Is it a laptop or a desktop?
It's a Dell laptop, and okay. It's a couple years old.
If you have a desktop computer, as I was saying to this previous caller, you could take the drive out of the USB enclosure, put it in on the, you'll need an adapter because it's a lap. I don't know what kind of drive it is in there. It might be just a standard full-size drive. But whatever, you might need a specific adapter for it. I don't know if it's SATA. I don't know exactly what it is, but it probably is SATA, which means you could just put it into a desktop computer. And then you're looking at the drive directly. And then you can run tools like SpinWrite, which I've mentioned to the last guy. That's the first one you run, the lowest level one, and see if that's enough to recover it. It could be so simple. It could be one sector, a critical partition sector that is unreadable. And then as a result, the operating system says, well, I can't tell anything about that drive, so I'm going to say it's empty. I'm going to say it's not even formatted.
Well, and if this means anything, as soon as I plug it into the USB drive, the light comes on and it flashes on about every 4 seconds.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
That's actually not meaningful.
Mark
Ward. That's the US. That it's not meaningful. That could just be the USB controller saying hello.
Yeah. So, okay, Leo.
I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Are we, when we're looking for a good sized drive to do backups on, should we be avoiding solid state?
If you want a reliable backup, you should get a multi-drive solution that uses RAID 5 so that if any one drive dies, you don't lose the data.
That's a better way to work.
In general, that's what I recommend. Or get multiple backups, you know, because drives die. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk to the photo guy, Chris Marquardt. He is our photography ace, an expert in both digital and film photography, a great photographer, and a leader of a great teacher, a leader of many photographic expeditions. You can find them all at discoverthetopfloor.com. And Chris is in the U.S. right now, visiting Rochester, New York, which is, anybody who's a photographer knows that name, the home of Eastman Kodak. I don't know if they're still around.
They are. They are still around. They still make film.
They went bankrupt in 2012, and I think what you're visiting is actually owned by the Kodak pension plan out of the United Kingdom, and that's Kodak Alaris, and that's who's making the film still, right?
Right, Kodak Alaris is making the film.
That's
they
hysterical.
Are still in the business. You can still buy your Tri-X. You can still buy your Provia. You can still buy. They brought back Ektachrome. They took it off the market. They re-engineered it because some of the chemistry that they used is not legal anymore. So you can't put it in products anymore. So they had to re-engineer the whole thing, and they're bringing Ektachrome. Well, they actually just brought Ektachrome back. So
the reason I mention that, though, is you'll see, when we were talking about the other day, products labeled Kodak, branded Kodak, but it's often a license. There is no – the Kodak we knew is gone. And so we were talking about a scanner called the Kodak Scanza. That's not made by – the old Eastman Kodak company. That's made by another company, probably a Chinese company, that licensed the name.
I'd be careful with digital products.
Yeah.
That's sake.
They got out of that business.
Kodak is partially in that because they are working on a Super 8 camera, of all things, that has a digital preview built in, and you can then send in the film and you get it back digitized. And it's in general, those the things that say Kodak and our film or analog are probably the real deal.
Yeah. But you can go to Kodak.com and, you know, it's still there, which is awesome.
True. So, Leo, I wanted to ask you, what is the worst conditions you've ever shot in with your cameras? The worst weather, environmental conditions that you ever had?
Probably just rain. I don't think snow. Certainly not. I didn't make it to Antarctica. I was ready, but we didn't make it. So the plane couldn't fly that day. So I think just plain old pouring rain. And I just, you know, even though some of my cameras are weatherproof, I put them under my jacket. I just don't want them to get wet. Why? I know the worst for you. It's Lofoten on the Arctic Circle, where it's minus 30 degrees or something like that, right?
Not too bad. Not too bad. No, but I just a few weeks ago, I was in Morocco, and that brought me to the Sahara.
Ooh.
And
ooh.
The first taste of the Sahara that I got was a sandstorm.
Well, that's pretty bad.
We drove into that area, and all of a sudden, the horizon turned orange, yellowish-orange, and I wasn't too bad. I mean, we were in the cars, right? But then we also visited the first dunes that we came across, and we stopped there, and we put our turbans on and our cloths around the face, and we went into the dunes to shoot, and which was a very interesting experience because just a few days earlier, it had rained, so there was the dunes were wet sand, at least on the top. Takes them a day or two to dry off, but there was still plenty of sand in the air, and we went out shooting. And so I just want to talk about a few points when you get to that. I mean, the beach is probably an equivalent, even though the sand in the Sahara is kind of finer, not as coarse. And I just want to briefly talk about a few things that you can do to make this, kind of safe for your camera, not too dangerous for the camera. First of all, and that's what I certainly did and most of the group did, is bring a spare camera body.
Just in case. Right? Yeah, you don't want to be cameraless. Yeah.
Don't want to be on a vacation like that and spend 2 weeks there and have your camera break on the first day. That's probably not a good idea. The second thing, what do you do when your camera gets dusty? Blow it off. Bring a blower. You know, these rubber bulb blowers that you squeeze with your hand and they have like a spout at the front. Those are pretty good to blow stuff off from the outside. And I would suggest doing this before you change lenses, for example.
Okay, good idea.
Do you know, there could be dust getting into the camera.
Worst thing, get them in the lens, of course, or the sensor.
Now, it's virtually impossible to not get dust in there. I mean, that's one of the secrets. If you have a zoom lens and you zoom, that tube will slide in and out, and the air has to go somewhere, and the air has to come in somewhere. So if you have, let's say, more professional grade lenses, they are normally better sealed against stuff getting in. They have little filters, little gaskets and things, but still, if the dust is small enough, and a lot of it is, it will get in there. So there is no way to completely avoid dust getting into the camera.
I actually, when we were on my trip, remember you told me, and I did, I only brought one camera, one lens. And I'm about halfway through the trip, I took a picture of the sky, and I saw this big blob on the sky.
Oh, yeah, dust on the sensor.
It was dust on the sensor. I went, oh, no, I don't have a backup. Fortunately, I had thought ahead, and I brought a blower. You know, one of those things is a bulb, and you go
right. Yep.
And fortunately, it blew out. I don't know what I would have done if it hadn't.
Well, you can clone them out later. Usually possible.
Yeah. Photoshop.
You can also bring a can of compressed air. Just don't change the lenses in a sandstorm.
That's good advice. Thank you.
I kind of did, but in the car. So right. I sat in the car. I waited for a minute to have everything settle down, and then I changed the lens, and that worked fairly well.
What about water? What about rain? Should I be worried about that?
Well, if you have gear, if you have a camera, or if you have lenses that are designated to be waterproof, water, and no, not waterproof, but
resistant. So, yes.
Resistant, splash proof,
rain. There
proof.
Is such a thing, but then, not all cameras are, right?
No, I usually have a microfiber cloth in the pocket and just wipe it off periodically. Right. That helps quite well. And then the last thing with these kind of situations, expect to, when you return from a vacation like this, expect to send your camera to a lab to have it cleaned. The word you're looking for is a CLA, a clean, lube, and adjust, which usually means you tell them I was in the Sahara, and they will know what to look for, and they'll take it apart and take all the sand out and return it to you for a fee in good condition. So
that's probably – do you do that every year, every 5 years?
No, but only after something trips? Like this, yeah. After something like the Sahara, I kind of want to make sure that everything is out again. I don't have any crunchy sounds when I focus, but I'll most likely send them in and have them looked at.
So Chris, it was a great success to bring the 150 millimeter, the nifty 50, as you say, and just take pictures. I was very happy, got a bunch of very nice images. But now I have the new Google Pixel 3 phone, which has a remarkable camera. And I'm considering maybe just bringing that on my next trip.
That would be cool, I guess, yeah. They are getting better and better.
You can zoom on this thing, and it does some sort of multi-image picture to make the zoom good, and it's quite amazing. At least I got a good backup camera if I need one.
Absolutely.
You'll find Chris Marquardt at his website, discoverthetopfloor.com. He does have a podcast called Tips from the Top Floor. It's an awesome podcast. He has a number of podcasts, including one on the future of photography, and does those great workshops. It's all at discoverthetopfloor.com. And we'll talk to you again next week, Chris.
See you then.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. Back to the phones we go. Bob in Hershey, PA. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Leo.
How are you today?
Good. How are you today?
I'm great. Does this smell like chocolate everywhere in Hershey?
Some days it does, yes.
That wouldn't be a bad thing.
That's never a bad thing.
Oh, I think it's good. You don't want to know what it smells like out here in farm country. Not chocolate. Mm-mm.
No.
What can I do for you today?
Well, I have an older Mac that I can't upgrade any longer. It's got El Capitan on it, and I wanted to see if I can do anything with that because, you know, I have older PCs, and I usually put Linux on it, but I wasn't sure about that. And
yeah,
I
it's a little harder on a Macintosh, unfortunately. There's a lot more proprietary stuff. But you can. I mean, if you look, you know, Google Linux and Macintosh, you'll find, you know, what the issues are and so forth. You know, Google your particular model. It's true of all computers. Not all computers work with Linux. Linux is a free and I think a very high quality operating system. I use it all the time, not as a fallback because my computer's old, but because I like it. And I think it would often work better on a low RAM, low processor computer than, you know, obviously Apple doesn't think it's good enough to run Mojave on it. So let's try that. Otherwise, you could continue to run it with El Capitan, but do something else with it. Make it a server. You can download the Apple server software from the App Store, put that on there, and it would probably run just fine. And when you put macOS server on there, you probably want to harden it a little bit because security, you know, you're not going to get security updates anymore. So, but that doesn't mean you can't use it as a server. The server itself, software itself, lets you turn off ports and things like that. Those are about the two things you can do with an old Mac. You can also donate it. And there may be people out there who would like it. How old is it? Is it iMac?
It's a MacBook Pro. It's from 2009, and it still runs.
Yeah, see, that's the sad thing. That's a perfectly fine MacBook Pro. The improvements Intel's made in the last 5 or 6 years have been negligible. So a 2009 MacBook Pro, you know, some of my employees are still using older MacBook Pros because I'm cheap and they work fine.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So you might be able to put Linux on it. You might not. It really, especially a laptop that even that gets even more proprietary. Linux is great, but it's supported in most cases by enthusiasts who create drivers for the hardware they use. And when you have Apple proprietary hardware, sometimes it's just not easy for them to write their own drivers, and so they may not exist. I think you might be able to do it. I would just Google it and see, you know, what will work and what won't.
Okay.
I would look at something like Kubuntu with a K, K-U-B-U-N-T-U, or Xubuntu, X-U-B-U-N-T-U. Those run well on older hardware. Okay.
Okay, very good.
Have a great one. Take care.
You too.
All right. Tyler, Oklahoma City. Hello, Tyler.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
Wonderful. Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Well, I've got an old Dell Inspiron 410 Dell Tower.
Okay.
I believe the manufacture date was 98.
Ah, that was a good year. I remember 98. Windows 98 had just come out.
Yep.
Wow.
Five years after I was born.
Oh, my. It's almost as old as you are.
Yes. Yeah, really is. And it's a friend of mine's, and their parents would like me to try to grab some data off.
You're the poor guy that gets that job, huh?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, I do a client pro support at Dell, so I guess it's appropriate.
You do? That's
awesome. I know nothing about this computer, and I actually can't find anything about it online.
But if you can't, how do you expect me to? You work at Dell, my friend.
That's not my actual question.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. What's your question?
So I've noticed it's got two male VGA ports for, I'm guessing, video. And then it's got some PS2 ports for mouse and keyboard and some old USB 1.0 ports.
Ah, the good old days, yes.
Yep. So will I be good to just use any PS2 mouse keyboard and then...
Yes, that's a standard.
And then use a female VGA cable?
Yeah. So it's unlikely that it has two. So one of the things
you'll see...
Really? And they've come off a video card? Okay.
Well, no, I...
So don't confuse VGA. You might confuse it with maybe a serial port or something like that.
Yep, that's what I was wondering. But I don't see any other obvious video connections.
Okay, so, you know, I mean, you'll know. There's the VGA. It's female, right?
No, it's male.
Oh, that's a serial port then. That's not a VGA connector. That's a serial port probably. Is it?
How will I get...
Let me think.
Yeah.
I have to remember back then. Let me see. Do I have anything that old around here? Just my shoes.
I took a VGA cable over and realized it was male. And
does
it
fit?
No,
oh, yeah.
Because it's male-male. But I did order an adapter, but I'm just not... I don't know if this is what's...
All the VGA connectors I know of are female. They're innies, not outies.
Yeah, same. That's
so I've never seen if it's an Audi, it's probably a serial port, not a video port.
So what was used to connect?
That would be for like joysticks.
or
serial cables for lap link or connecting printers and funky old things. So yeah, you're wondering. You're asking a very good question. Where's the video?
Yep.
There's nothing on the back that could look like a video connector, huh?
Not at all. I mean, I had to... Those USB ports barely looked recognizable to make sure something fit.
The VGA port will be usually a blue female port with 15 dots. That's the connector, 15 pins. If you don't see that...
Well, I've got that. It's just male, but...
Well, that's a DB15 then. You've got a that's a serial port. That's a DB15.
Okay.
That'll be for your modem. Remember modems?
Barely. Barely.
Does this sound ring a bell? So So I don't. You got to find a video. There's got to be. Well, maybe does there? There has to be a video port on that thing somewhere. One of those things that you think is not a video port.
Yeah, must be the video port.
Must be the video port.
What other common connectors and ports were used then for
1998? Yeah, VGA was the one.
And I've got a female to female.
Hang on a second. I'm going to have you send me a picture. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So can you take a picture of it and send it to me? Or are you there right now?
Well, I think I've got one on my computer. No, it's at a remote location, but
okay.
I do have.
If you send a picture to me, I can show the chat room. And I bet you we can figure out what everything is. So send it to leo@leoville.com.
Okay, one moment here. I've got it.
Leo, L-E-O, at leoville.com. They might have had DVI. Yeah, what's... Well, he's got... He said he can't even... He works... He's Dell Pro Support. There's not even in the database anymore.
Leo at L-E-O-V-I-L-L-E.
.com. Yes, sir.
Got it.
And then what I will do is I will show the chat room. It could be, I wonder if it's DVI. That would be a longer socket with a little plus sign on one end of it. Does that ring a bell? Here, I'll show you. It's the connector.
No, but it's sending now.
All right. Well, you know what? This will be fun. This will be work for the work for the chat room. We're gonna look at your message.
Chat room. If I couldn't get through to you, I would ask them.
They will know.
And
if you give me if I've got a picture, let's see. You sent to Leo at Leoville. Let's see if it went to spam. It may not have come through yet.
Looks like it's still uploading, but
it's a big
buzzer. Almost there.
Yeah. We have another picture. I want the chat room to identify. I've got a guy who came to the studio 10 years ago, who has a lovely twit tattoo. And I just wonder whatever happened to him.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
All right, let's see if we got it here. It went out?
Yep. Right. Should be there.
All right.
I may have to get a Security Now tattoo at some point.
Yeah, there you go. So Dell Pro Support's the best. You guys do a great job. I always tell people, if you're getting a Dell, get the gold, get the Pro Support.
Yes. I think it's a pretty good deal, too.
Yeah. Good. Do you enjoy it, or is it frustrating?
Yes, yeah. No, I love it. I mean, our customers love it as well.
There you go, Tyler. I can see it right now. All right. Here you go. We're going to...
And it's pretty funky. I searched Inspiron 410, and they made something called a Zion.
Zion.
A few years back. Well, it's Z-I-O-N.
Zion?
Huh. Some, little HD media PC-looking thing, but... And that, I think, clouded the result of...
So that's a printer. Gotten. That's a Centronics printer port. I don't know what this is. What is that, a video port, guys? What is that? These are serial ports. That's why it says I-O, I-O, I-O.
Yeah.
I see the mouse and keyboard. I mean, they're labeled... And, USB and Ethernet.
So
up at the top, I'm thinking up at the top.
Well,
what is that? What is that thing on the left? What is, that's SCSI. Oh, man, yeah, that's SCSI. That's the SCSI. So I don't see a video adapter on here. It's just headless. It's a server. You got a server here. There is you are right. There is no video connector on here.
Yeah, okay.
Now, do you have slots on that thing?
Yes. Well, I haven't opened it up. But
okay, so there's probably... This is just the back panel of the motherboard. And in those days, that was not at all uncommon. There would be a standalone video card, and that would be on the slots of the machine. So
if I purchase a 8400 GT...
No, don't buy a video card. You cannot buy a video card for this. Are they... They've never used it? Are they not using it?
No.
So they haven't used it in ages.
Well, but they use it as a home computer, actually.
So there's a video card. There must be a video card in there.
Okay.
So Yeah, because in these days, they didn't have motherboards with video on them. They had a standalone. In fact, I'm surprised they have a sound interface. So maybe they did have video. But
yeah, it's got a couple optical drives in the front and a floppy drive. So
yeah, they'll be open the case. There'll be a video card somewhere.
Okay.
There's got to be.
Connected.
Yeah, because this is SCSI Centronics for the printer. Two serial ports. It's actually kind of fun to see this. This is a trip down memory lane here.
So, and I get to keep it after, so.
Well, I don't know what you're going to do with it. So SCSI.
Well, I'll put it on the shelf.
SCSI Centronics. That's a parallel port printer. So that's parallel port. This is, those are two DB9 ports for serial. They're 9-pin serial ports. Those aren't VGA. Then there's the PS2 keyboard and mouse, microphone, speakers, input, USB, and Ethernet. That's it. Worst case, you could put it on the network. Well, no, but you know, that's not going to work.
That's not 95, gonna work. Windows 95?
Yeah, no, you're not going to work. Yeah, there's not. That goes to a museum.
What about the drive in there? Could I just detach that? And
yeah, that's actually, well, the drive's going to be an IDE drive, so you're
that should be okay. If
you
I
need an IDE interface card, which you can usually put in a standard tower up on the bus, and a cable, and then you'd be able to do that. Yeah.
Would I be able to get a enclosure, an external enclosure?
Yes. You might be able to get, I don't know, ID external enclosure. That's an interesting.
That's kind of weird, yeah. But I can search. Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. You could also, no, but he can't see anything. But how big is the drive? How big is the drive? Yeah, really, the drive's probably like.
I haven't opened it up.
It's probably a gigabyte at best. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I remember these old devices.
Well, yeah, I'll have to open it up and see what I'm working with.
You can. It looks like you can still get IDE hard drive enclosures of all things. Amazon's got them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that would be the way to do it.
Okay. Sounds good.
Have fun.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Been looking for a way to connect the monitor for too long. So
I love it. Thank you for sending the picture. What fun that is.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Take care.
Have
a good day. You too.
Bye bye.
Thanks. Awesome. 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 Great call. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches. We talked to Tyler before the show break, and he is a Dell professional support technician. And that's why his in-laws gave him a 20-year-old Dell computer and said, hey, Tyler, can you get the data off of here? And he's looking at that and going, I don't know what that is. It's not in our database. I got some help for you, Tyler. I found a guy named Steve. He can help you out.
Mom, Dad, hey, it's me, Steve. This year, to avoid any confusion, I'm putting my wish list on video. All I want is a computer. Now, hold on, Dad. It's just $849. For all of this, a Dell computer, speakers, monitor, 1 year of MSN internet access, an Intel Pentium 3 processor, which is awesome. I even cleared space for it. And Dell will throw in a free DVD upgrade. And Dad, I know how much you love free stuff.
Dude, you're getting a Dell. Oh, those, we were plagued with those. Well, that's right about that time, too. I would guess that was around 1998. Dude, you're getting a Dell. He did send me a picture. We were able to identify the back panel on that computer, and there was no video card at all. Now I remember, of course, in those days, you usually had a dedicated video card. So we sent him off to do some more homework. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. I love those. Those were the days, my friends. Oh, well, before Twitter. Before Facebook, Google was just a twinkle in Larry Page's eye. Computing was simple back then. Barry in Torrance, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Leo. This is Barry. Got a little problem here. when I play my Amazon Music and I get a, and I'm in my car, I get a phone call, and instead of pausing the music, it unpairs my phone.
It just drops it right off, huh?
Just drops it like a rock.
and then you have to start over?
Pull over to the side of the road, reconnect. Man.
So
I spent hours at my local Infiniti dealer, and they pretty well convinced me it's not an Infiniti problem because we were able to pair it up with an Android, and it doesn't have the problem with an Android.
Oh, interesting. Which iPhone is it?
8S, and I also had it on my 7S.
It's a recent Android, and the same thing happened on both. I mean, recent iPhone, and both.
No. Yes.
Same thing happened on both. Huh.
Correct.
Well, you know, it's funny because my experience has generally been, first of all, Bluetooth is terrible. Bluetooth is terrible. But it's all we got, right? There's no other way to connect that phone to your audio system. But Bluetooth is terrible. Normally, in my experience, the iPhone seemed to always work because more than half of all the phones in the United States are iPhones. So car companies generally test with the iPhones and make sure the iPhones work. It's often an Android phone that I have problems with, like just like this with. I am not sure it shouldn't happen. It isn't, by the way, it isn't Apple's fault. It's Infiniti's fault. But you can't fully blame them because it's Bluetooth.
you know?
But this should, nevertheless, I could see how the phone rings. It might, lose track of the Amazon Music and not come back with sound, but you should be able to start it up again and play it again.
Yeah,
you're exactly. Saying you don't see it at all. You have to find it again.
Yes, I've got to repair my phone.
There's something. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. I don't have a fix for you on that. You were right to bring it to Infiniti. They were wrong to say it's not their fault because you have one of the most. You know, there are literally 100 million iPhone 8s in the world or more. And I would guess a large number of them work fine.
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody complain about it.
And you've even used two different iPhones, a 7 and an 8,
correct.
And it still things still happens. So of course it's Infiniti's fault. Because obviously it has to be, but what the fix is, I don't know. I mean,
I know.
You unpair it and pair it again, but I was normally what I would say, but you're doing that anyway. You have to.
All I can do is take it back to Infiniti and have them run some kind of sanity.
Is it only Amazon Music? I mean, if you have other things playing, does it happen too? Like if you're just in your car and somebody calls. You're not listening to music. Somebody calls. Do you have to repair the phone after the phone call?
No.
Mm-mm. Interesting. I wonder if you tried listening to something else, if the same thing would happen. Because maybe it is something going on with Amazon Music, right?
Yeah, it could be. I suppose I could try iTunes with it.
Yeah, it's worth it. This is the process of troubleshooting is exactly this. You change variables around until you can see what the cause of it is. It's the only other possibility is that it's this unique combination of Amazon Music and the phone. You should look in the settings. Some phones will give you a choice, and maybe Amazon Music will give you a choice. I'm trying to remember about what to do when the phone rings while you're listening to music. It may say, "Would you like me to stop the music or duck the music, lower the music volume?" And it may be that there is a setting in Amazon Music that you can change. It will change its behavior there too. So I would look at that. So there's your assignment. Instead of bringing it back to Infiniti, because frankly, it doesn't sound like that's going to be much help. But your assignment is try it with Apple Music. See if the same thing happens. Get your wife to call you or something. And then if the same thing does not happen, it's something to do with Amazon Music, and maybe there's a setting in Amazon Music. Many music apps do have settings that say how to handle it when a phone call comes in. You know, what should I do?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's a nice thing to do, but I'm not sure if that's it, but that's worth a try anyway.
Okay, I'll give it a shot.
Hey, thanks for the call. Anybody has an idea, 88 88 Ask Leo, or visit us in the chat room. You know, we have a great, have I mentioned? We have a great chat room. All the people who watch or listen to the show live, a lot of them like to go in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can do that from the website, or you can get an IRC client. That's the old-fashioned internet relay chat, which we've been doing. I've been doing this show since about 94, longer than that Dell computer's been around, since Tyler was born, actually. And we've had a chat room ever since, all the time, because I just I love having kind of people in the chat room be my, I call them the team tech guy that kind of help out. So you can go in the chat room. Dr. Mom says, I used to have an, she's in the chat room, I used to have an Infinity. They don't duck the music, then switch streams. And mine used to switch back to the music after the call ended. Well, yep. Try another form of music is, I guess, what the chat room's saying. If you have an idea, you can go there. You can also call 8888 Ask Leo, or go to our website, which is techguylabs.com. And as I mentioned before, it's free. There's no sign up. It's, you know, like the old days on the internet where you'd actually go to a website and you just browse it. And wow, this is cool. Nice. All 1,538 shows are there, audio and video from the previous ones, plus text with my answers and links and so forth. And there's a comment section, so you can go right into an individual show and even to an individual caller and say, hey, I have an Infinity and I had this happen and here's how I fixed it. That would be the ideal comment. That would really be nice if you could do that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up in just a bit. Stay right here. The Tech Guy podcast brought to you this week by Rocket Mortgage. Many, many of your homes brought to you by Rocket Mortgage too, right? From Quicken Loans. They are, after all, the largest mortgage lender in the country. Rightly so. When you're the best, you ought to be the biggest. It's just fair, right? For 8 years in a row, they've been number one, according to J.D. Power, in customer satisfaction. The thing I like about Quicken Loans, they don't feel big. They feel personal, and they really can get you where you want to be in a brand new home. You know, we very few of us can write a check for a new home. You got to get a loan. You got to get a home loan. But the problem with it is it's in traditionally in the past been a big, you know, ordeal. You got to go to a bank and all dressed up, right? Because you got to look good. You don't can't go to a bank looking like you need the loan. They only lend money to people who don't need the money. So you get all dressed up, put on a nice dress or suit and stuff and say, please, sir, may I have some money? I don't need it, but I'd like it. And then they say, well, sure. Here's a 20-page application. Go home, fill it out. Start faxing us. You got to go up the attic, get the pay stubs from the job 3 jobs ago, get the bank statements from 2010, all of that stuff. Start faxing it off. We did this, Lisa and I, when we bought our house 5 years ago with the big bank, the one with the stagecoach and the horses and the whips. And it took us 2 months. We almost lost the house. The seller was saying, what's going on, guys? We applied for the loan late August. And we knew that we were going on vacation in late September. We thought, well, we'll have the loan by then. No. Mm-mm. So we filled out the application. It wasn't that it took a long time. It's that they kept coming back. They said, well, now we need this. Now we need that. And, you know, we got to find it. We got to fax. It was such a pain in the butt. And then so we go on vacation. It's still not done. We're going, oh, boy. We had to get Lisa's sister, Debbie, to start faxing them stuff. We go on vacation. We finally come back. I know because I remember the date, October 7th. This is back in 2013. We finally got the loan. We applied in August. We finally got the loan October 7th. I said, never again. Fortunately, I don't have to because Quicken Loans has something called Rocket Mortgage that transforms this process. It's entirely online. You go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. They have an online application. It's just a few questions. Actually, they call it the power buying process. Let me walk through this. It's 3 steps. Step one, rocketmortgage.com/techguy. You create an account. You answer a few simple questions. They check your credit. They say, okay, you qualify for these loans. You choose the term, the rate, the down payment. They say, great, you've pre-qualified approval. Step one. Step two happens, and really without any effort on your part usually, they just go out and verify your income, your assets, and your credit. They have relationships with all the financial institutions. You just give them permission, and they go out and do that. You don't have to go to the attic and get your pay stubs or anything. And then within 24 hours, usually, So 10 minutes to the pre-qualified approval, right? Then another day, you're going to get verified approval, and you get a letter, and you get to give this letter to your realtor or the seller. I wish we'd had this, because our seller got so antsy. Like, it's been 2 months. Are you going to buy this? With a letter, it says, we're good for it. You're a cash buyer, basically. You move right to the front of the line. Then step three, and this is good. Nowadays, you need this because interest rates have started to go up, right? The Fed's raising the interest rates. That means all the indexes are going up. Once you're verified, step three, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They lock your rate. They say, all right, you got 90 days, up to 90 days to shop to find a house, and we promise that rate will not go up. Interest rates might go up. Indexes go up. We're not going to raise your rate. You've got it locked. If rates go down, they don't have to do this. I like it that they do. If rates go down, your rate will go down, but it just can't go up. So you win either way. That's why their number one customer satisfaction. They think about your experience. Rocket, it's easy. Rocketmortgage.com/techguy. You can bet we're not going to the bank next time. We're going to Rocket Mortgage. Rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Actually, I hope we never, every time I buy a house and move in, I say, they're taking me out in a pine box. I am never leaving. That hasn't happened yet. We actually have lived in this house probably longer than I have in a long time. Usually it's about 3 or 4 years. This one's been in 5 years now. Knock on wood. We're not. But when we do, we'll be going to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and their NMLSconsumerAccess.org number is 3030. Rocketmortgage.com/techguy. That's all you have to remember. Rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And I thank Rocket Mortgage and Quicken Loans for making the Tech Guy podcast possible. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Line one, Garrett, Chico, California. Hello, Garrett.
Hey, Leo, long time listener, first time caller. Really
bless you.
With you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you finally.
Way back in the screensaver days and that. I've got a Pixel 2, and it takes amazing photos and amazing video. And I can go on to my Google Photos site, obviously, and download video. But is there a way to connect my phone directly to a computer and do a download of a higher quality video so that I can get the best quality possible?
Yes. So all Android phones can do this. You need to get a USB cable, and you need to get the on some machines, like a Macintosh, you need to get the appropriate software. On Windows, I think you don't even need special software. It'll just mount as a drive, a USB drive, and you can see it. What will happen when you plug the USB drive, you need one that has obviously a Type-C connection for the Pixel, and then whatever your computer needs, possibly Type-A, maybe a Type-C. You connect the two, and the Pixel will at that point say, you're connected to USB. Would you like me to be? And it gives you a choice of MTP, Media Transport Protocol, or PTP, Photo Transport Protocol. And you get, actually, either one would work for you. Media would let you actually browse the folders on the Pixel. You'd have to find that movies folder, and then you could just copy the file right out of it. PTP would make the phone look like a camera to your PC, and then whatever happens when you connect a camera to your PC would happen. And that's something that you chose or you choose in the settings. But maybe a Photos app would load up, or maybe just Windows Explorer and you could copy the files that way. So all you really need is a cable.
And I'm correct that it would be higher quality that way.
Well, it would be the original quality. I know what you're talking about. With Google Photos, in some cases they reduce the quality. Remember, you bought a Pixel, and one of the deals that came with the Pixel is that you would get unlimited full-quality pictures on Google Photos.
Right.
So I'm not sure it'll be better quality. I don't know. I mean, for sure, the pictures that it's uploading from Pixel phones are full quality. They're not squeezed much. Frankly, even the pictures I upload from non-Pixel phones look almost identical to the originals, if not exactly the same. They don't squeeze them that much. Videos, I'm not sure. But I suspect that would include video. In any event, this is a good technique to have. If you have a Mac, you often have to download something called the Android File Transfer Manager. It's a free program you download. It doesn't work very well, but it basically makes the Mac able to see the Android device. On Windows, it should just show up.
Perfect.
Okay. Thanks for listening.
Right, thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Thanks for calling. Now that you know the way, come on back anytime, Garrett. You know, it's nice. One of the things Google did, and this is unheard of, so I want to commend them for that. They, with the release of the Pixel 3 phone, their new smartphone, they've got really amazing new, we call it computational photographic capabilities. The camera, and when I say camera, I don't mean the hardware camera. I mean the software camera app on the Pixel 3 can do some amazing things. And in fact, it's based on a separate processing chip that they've put in the Pixel phones that can do these computations. And the stuff they're doing is just kind of mind-boggling. They have a night shot mode that takes many, many, many images and merges them, some as slow as a quarter of a second, which you really couldn't handhold without blur. But they take it, and then they take faster shutter speeds, and they combine them looking for the best quality in each image and then combine it into a single image that's remarkable. They have portrait modes, I think, that are even better than what Apple's doing with a portrait mode. Lots of very interesting techniques. They have a top shot mode that will take pictures the minute you raise the phone, even before you press the shutter. And then after you press the shutter, it'll look through the images it took, the 20 or 30 images it took, pick the best one and say, we think this is the best one, where everybody's eyes are open and Joe is smiling, which he never does. And then you could say, yeah, that's the best one. Or you can scroll through them and say, no, no, this is the best one, and pick it. Things like that. The reason I commend Google is many of these features are actually going to be downported to the older Pixel phone, the Pixel 2 phone. And I think maybe, I don't know how far down they're going to go, but I think probably just the Pixel 2, because it also has that special digital signal processing chip, the DSP chip that allows the Pixel 3 to do all this stuff. So many of these features, I don't know if it'll be as good, but many of these features will be migrated down to the Pixel 2 phone as well. So you're going to get a little camera upgrade. The night shot is not out yet. People have seen it. Should be coming out soon, very soon. So not all. That's another thing. The camera's going to get better as they release new software. So very impressive. They have a very funny, Scooter X is reminding me, and I'll put a link in the show notes, to a very funny Top Shot ad that Google showed at their event of all the bad pictures. You know, and it's a problem with camera phones, because by the time you get it out and you line it up and you push the shutter, you know, there's a, the dog has left the picture, or people's eyes are closed, or everybody's walking away. So it's really nice, this Top Shot idea that, you know, honestly, the picture you took isn't the best one. You go back four frames and there's a better one. It's a great ad. We'll put a link in the show notes. Thank you, Scooter X, to that Top Shot commercial. Line two, John, Fallbrook, California. Hello, John.
Hi, Leo. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, thanks. I've heard you talk about this before, but I wasn't remembering it as well as I should. Right. We're going on a cruise, and I wonder, while I'm using no Wi-Fi to stream your program, should I put on VPN?
Well, that's a really interesting question. When you're on a communal Wi-Fi, as you will be on that cruise, or a hotel or a coffee shop, you're all on the same network. Everybody is using that Wi-Fi. Now, nowadays, I have to say, people are getting better. Cruise ships and hotels and coffee shops are getting better about making it more secure. So it's not maybe as risky as it used to be. But there is this potential risk of you know, somebody else on that network taking advantage of the fact that you're on the same network and you know, kind of trying to snoop on you. I think it's pretty safe. Yeah, I went on a cruise with a friend of mine who's a bit of a hacker, Randall Schwartz, and on the first day of the cruise, he went around to all of us in the group and showed us our email password and said, you know, I can see that. And the reason was, in those days, email wasn't generally encrypted. When you logged into your email, it was set in clear and he could see it. Now, those days are gone. If you use Gmail or almost any email package, that password's encrypted. So that isn't going to happen. I wouldn't worry about it. I really wouldn't. Plus, a VPN is going to slow you down enough that live streams of audio and video may not work very well. So when you're banking or buying something on Amazon, that's encrypted too. I think you're probably okay. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. When I come back, I'll tell you what you could do. I take a little travel router with me that might help a little bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. On we go to line 3, Bianca, Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, Leo. I am a longtime fan. I've been watching you since the Tech TV days, back with Screensavers and Call for Help.
Oh, thank you, Bianca. And I've been watching your Green Bay Packers my whole life. What can I do for you today?
I am looking to upgrade. We currently have an AC router, and I'm looking to upgrade to an affordable mesh router system, but I'm not sure what to get.
Affordable and mesh don't usually go together. I like the new mesh router systems, but really, in a way, it's a new way of thinking about your router. And one of the new things is they're going to cost you. Partly because mesh systems tend to come with a base unit and one, two, or three or more extenders. And that's one of the advantages of mesh, is it's extending your Wi-Fi signal more evenly throughout the house. You know, the way it works right now with a single router, it's plugged into your DSL modem or your cable modem. And that base station is a little radio transmitter receiver, right? It's got antennas on it. It's sitting there. It works best when you're next to it, like any transmitter. The farther away you get, the weaker the signal gets. And the weaker the signal, it turns out, with Wi-Fi, the slower the speed. And then, depending on the device you're using, at some point, it just cuts off. You don't get Wi-Fi. So you've got a kind of a central point in a pool, and then it's spreading out and getting weaker and weaker. With these extenders, if you get a Wi-Fi extender, which is what people used for a long time, you can get a kind of another radio. But the problem with extenders, it slows the Wi-Fi down by half, because half the time you're talking to the extender, half the time the base unit's talking to the extender. So it's half duplex. It can't use all of the bandwidth. So if you've got Wi-Fi that gives you 80 megabits a second, when you use the extender, you're going to get 40. So that's when mesh came out. Mesh does the same thing, but mesh uses a separate back channel that doesn't slow you down. So these mesh extenders give you full speed. And then the other thing that mesh tends to do, and it's not a requirement of mesh, but it's often the case, is that they usually do regular updates, that they pay attention to your network topology. They actually start to know what devices are on. And when it says, oh, she's watching Netflix on her Roku, we're going to make sure that that stream is quality, but that may mean we slow down the son in the bedroom who's getting his email. So they can actually start to shape your bandwidth to give you better results. In fact, one of the things you notice with mesh is you don't always get the highest speed possible on mesh, and that's because mesh is doing some bandwidth shaping. The theory is you always get enough. You may not get the maximum, but you always get enough. So they're very sophisticated. Our sponsor on the podcast is Eero, and that was one of the very first, E-E-R-O. But there are others. Another one I really like a lot, not a sponsor, is Netgear and their Orbi. The Orbis are kind of pseudo mesh, and they tend to give you the fastest throughput. So unlike an Eero, which will actually look like maybe you're getting 30 megabits instead of 40, because again, it's trying to figure out who needs that bandwidth when, the Orbis don't do that kind of bandwidth shaping. So they tend to be highest speed throughout the house. If that's the priority, then maybe the Orbis are a good one. If price is a priority, then there are lower cost mesh systems out now. TP-Link has a mesh system. They tend to be very inexpensive, but they make good network gear. I like the TP-Link stuff. Theirs is called the Deco, D-E-C-O. And then there's also the Velop, which I think tends to be a little bit less expensive because it's from Linksys, which is a low-cost leader. I use also at home, besides the Eero's, which we've been very, very happy with, I also use the Plumes, P-L-U-M-E. It has a somewhat different philosophy. Plume has a bunch of, and by the way, Comcast is a big investor. And now if you get the Comcast mesh system, the Xfinity mesh system, it'll be a, it'll have little plume modules. These little modules just plug into the wall and you're supposed to use one for every room. So the idea is instead of taking your pool of Wi-Fi and spreading it evenly throughout the house, it's creating many small pools of high-speed 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi. So it's a little bit Plume is a good choice if you need to spread it out in specific directions or if you're getting problems with interference from neighbors because 5G is less prone to interference because it doesn't go through walls. That's why the Plumes are really designed one per room. It doesn't go through walls very well. So there, as you guys, I just have kind of muddied the waters incredibly for you, and I apologize. You could see there's a lot of things to think about. You can, how big is this area you want to wire?
It's a smallish house.
Okay. A couple of thousand square feet?
I think so, somewhere around there. It's a like two bedroom.
Yeah, you probably don't need a big.
Just be able to extend it to the, like towards the backyard area.
Yeah,
like to the back, you know, to the back door area ish.
So you probably don't need many
phones.
You probably don't many
Wi-Fi.
Yeah, you don't need many base stations. Each station is about 1,500 square feet. So really, one base station, like an Eero base station, and one beacon, which is their extender, would probably be enough. Do look at the Orbeez if you want to get out in the backyard. They're the only one that makes an outdoor extender. If you've got a plug outside that you can plug it into, it's weatherproof. So there's an advantage to that as well. The other thing to keep in mind is that most of these companies, Plume for sure, Eero and others, have subscriptions. Plume requires you to subscribe. I think it's $100 a year. Eero gives you the option, but you're going to want to subscribe because the subscriptions give you a lot of additional features, including if you've got kids in the house, things like content restriction so you can keep them off of bad sites, the ability to pause their internet. I find this fantastic. We have a 15-year-old, and we have it set so that our internet continues. We can go on late at night, but his stops at 10 p.m. on school nights. He can't get online because we disable his internet, and that's just for his devices. So those kinds of features, I think, are fantastic. Eero also has ad blocking. It comes with a password manager, a VPN, a whole bunch of extra stuff for the subscription. So, and the other thing I think the subscription, and again, this is, we have to rethink Wi-Fi. We're used to buying a router and owning it for 5 years and not paying a penny and it not getting updated and all sorts of security flaws. The other reason I don't mind paying subscription fees is it really incentivizes these companies to keep their routers up to date. And that has become very, very important. The router is now a really vulnerable target to bad guys. We've seen lots of router malware. So
that's one of the reasons why I'm looking at updating.
Smart.
In some of the things that have been happening.
Absolutely.
And I've seen, from watching you, that the mesh seemed to be some of the most secure ways to go with the because they keep it updated and everything like that's the way to go for security.
I'm very happy with the Eero's. That is my first recommendation. You can, and for you, it sounds like one base station and one beacon would be enough. So that's going to be a little less expensive. The 3-unit set, I think, is about $300. So these are expensive. There's no $40 routers anywhere anymore. You don't want those $40 routers because those companies like Linksys, which used to sell those cheap routers, they never updated them. And that's why there's all these, you know, VPN filter and these other bad malware floating around because they just never updated them. So it is worth, I think, spending a little bit more for a better quality router. And you could go out and get an Asus. Asus makes excellent single unit routers. That are probably for a smaller area sufficient. I think Asus now also has mesh features built into a lot of their systems as well as their own mesh. So it's called Lyra. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 ask Leo, the phone number. Mike, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Leo. How you doing, buddy?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. Love the show.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, I don't know if you can help me with this, but I got a quick question for you. I've got one of these Sony stereo systems. It's got a tape player, a tuner, and a 5-CD loader. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You put 5 CDs in it and it'll play.
I remember those days, yeah.
It's old. It's probably going back 10 years, but
yeah,
it worked fine, but all of a sudden the tray that loads up the CDs just jammed. I can't even get the daggum.
Oh, daggummit. So it's one of those, it's like a turntable, but it's got 5 CD holes in it.
It's got 5 slots in
it. Yeah, and you close it.
Yeah, and it's portable.
Yeah, I used to have one of those.
Other than tearing the whole thing apart, which I think I'm going to have to.
That's what you're going to have to do because it's mechanically stuck. Probably what's happened is the CD's got tilted up or it's keeping it from coming out. What the worst thing that can happen, this used to be a real problem. People burn their own CDs and they put sticky labels. You know, go to Avery and get a CD label, put a sticky label on it.
Even I'm not that dumb. Pretty dumb.
You know what happens, right? They
jam up all
the way. The heat loosens the glue and the thing curls up and then it got glue all over it and it can ruin one of those things. Good. So as long as you're using commercial CDs, it could be, you know, and got rattled around and one of the CDs stuck. They're not too hard to open up the back. There'll be some screws.
I think it's only 4 screws.
Yeah, exactly. You slide off the back and you'll be able to see the mechanism, at least see if there's something getting in the way.
Actually, this thing is stacked. They have the CD on the bottom and then the tuner and then the amp.
Oh, it's all in one unit. Oh, that might be a little harder to get to.
I think it's going
to
be 8 screws. I just have to tear the whole thing apart.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any way around it. I thought maybe...
One thing... Yeah, all my years working with CD changers, the one thing, sometimes there's a little release on the front. You might see a little tiny hole about the size of a paperclip, end of a paperclip. And sometimes you can put a thing in there and press a catch that will release it.
I'll try that.
Yeah, so sometimes what's happening is the software in the CD changer, because there is some software controlling it, is locking it. And you can physically release that by sticking a paper clip, you know, unbending a paper clip, sticking the hole.
I'm looking at it. I don't see it, bro.
Yeah, you may not have that. That's more likely on a single CD player. I don't know if the changer would have that. That would be my only thing, you know. Otherwise, yeah, it looks like taking it apart.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Leo. Appreciate
it. My pleasure. I'm glad you're listening. All right. Thanks, Mike. Take care. Yeah. I had one of those in my car, but you'd feed it, right? And it would somehow magically, and then you'd put another one in. And then even my older car, it had a disc pack, so you could put CDs. Oh, I'm so glad those days are gone. Now we use Bluetooth, and it just drops out, and you have to repair it. That's, you know. Oy. The more things get better, the worse they get. I think maybe our last call of the day. I don't know. John on the line from Vernon, Florida. Hello, John.
Hello, Mr. Leo. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
Getting over the flu, and we just got past the hurricane a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, man. Okay.
We're kind of getting through it. We're kind of getting
You know what? It's going to get better.
Oh, it always does. It always does.
Can't get any worse. What can I? Did you survive the hurricane okay?
Yeah, we're about 25 miles inland, but south of us in Panama City, it's
scary.
Really devastated.
It's so scary.
Folks out there living in tents and those kind of things.
I feel so bad. And, you know, it takes so long to get...
We can survive.
Yeah, you can survive. And I know the good thing is people really come together when these things happen, and you see the best of people. But at the same time, it takes a long time to recover. I know, because we had fires up here, and it's the same thing, you know.
Yes, sir. I can empathize with that. Yeah, I was amazed that just the politeness of everyone around here during our crisis. Everybody was just paying it forward. It was just community and just strangers from Ohio, and it was just super awesome.
Good. Glad to hear it. Now, what can I do to make your life better?
I've got a question for you. I was going to mention one thing really quick, though. The guy with the MacBook Pro that called a little bit earlier, the 2011.
Yes.
When you reassemble that, make sure over on the side of the video port, the video adapter, don't get your screws mixed up because they're
there's long ones and there's short ones.
Yeah. If you don't, then you're going to have to be desoldering that video card or you're going to get that up.
It's the voice of experience, my friends. Sounds like you've been there, John.
Been there, done that.
Oh, Lord.
I'm a long-time developer.
You're right. I used to, the folks at iFixit make a magnetic whiteboard that will hold the screws, and you can write, you know, left, top left, right, bottom left, and you, because it's really important you keep track of those. That's a great idea. Or take a piece of right, masking tape and put them on there like that.
Right. Yeah, I got the little magnetic lights. I did iPhone and iPad repair for
about. Oh, you know all about
the importance of those.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have, on the other side of the hardware, which I kind of do both, but I have a question for you about on the development side of things. I've been a programmer here for about, since 86.
Wow.
I've been a web developer since probably about 20 years now.
Nice.
But I have a question for you.
Yes.
And what I want to do is, I have, say, for instance, I have a Mac. That's what I use for my development system. And I have to run processes, for instance. I have to use SAS compilers to compile my CSS.
Yes.
For instance, I have
yes,
to run Node and NPM.
Yep.
And this and that and the other.
Yep.
Currently, what I've been using for the last few years is a framework from Zurb called Foundation.
Okay.
And one of the issues that I run into with Foundation is there's a version 5 and there's a version 6, but they will not run together. What I was looking at doing is possibly looking at something like DigitalOcean, where I can go out there and set up basically a Linux runtime.
Exactly what I do, and I'll tell you why. Even though on the Mac you have a full Unix OS, so you can run Node, you can run SAS, you can do all of that stuff on the Mac, but you nailed it, which is you might have different tool sets for different projects. And
right,
there are, you know, look at Homebrew. There are ways of saying, you know, okay, this project is Python 3, this project's Python 2.
Right.
Most programming languages and maybe even Foundation have ways to do that. I honestly think it's good to do it in a virtual machine of some kind. And frankly, because I'm starting to look at iPad development, which doesn't have that command line capability. More and more, I'm looking at exactly what you just talked about. Now, I have a Linux server at home that I can use, but DigitalOcean's great because they're cheap. You can have 5 different instances with each one with a different tool set enabled, and then use SSH, use your command line tool to log into them and work in them. You can even have them have a public web front end so you can even see how it's working. So I think DigitalOcean, which is a sponsor, I should mention, is a very good way to do this. There are a lot of different companies that do it, but it's fairly affordable. It's a few bucks a month per instance. I think it's a great idea.
Okay, what I have one question. This is the little fine question here.
Yeah.
Is developing through my office. Let's say I want to carry a laptop, and then I might run Linux, I might run Atom, I might run Sublime
right,
or whatever.
Yep.
What is the best method? And I've gotten, and I've kind of checked in.
You got to learn Emacs, yet, dude.
I'm looking. Well, no. Please do not say that.
Hey, I got to take a break. I'll talk to you off the air. It's all about Emacs. We're out of time. I want to thank Big Pee-wee, our new musical director, along with Michael Cozio, Kim Schaffer, for answering the phones. And most of all, I want to thank you for being here. I couldn't do this show without you, so thank you. And I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week now. Yeah, so there are some editors that are cross-platform like that, you know, or will allow you to do that. But honestly, what I end up doing is using VI or Vim or Emacs because they work over a terminal connection, right?
Right. Well, I was thinking about doing that, but, you know, actually what I was thinking about doing is, you know, I could use Sublime on the Mac, and then I could use Atom somewhere else. But the interesting thing I was looking at is how can I get these files to sync between all the devices?
Git.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking
yep,
about, it is Git. And I looked
yep,
at, I think FileZilla has a direct resync.
I would just use
that.
Git. I would totally just use Git. You can either do it's easy to install Git on the Mac, or you can use GitHub or GitLab, which are Git server services. And honestly, they're free for basic use. Or you can run your own Git. I use a company called Keybase, which offers an encrypted Git, and that's where I keep my .dot files. Anything I want to keep secure, including like income taxes and PGP keys and stuff, I keep it on Keybase because they have a secure Git. And you just use Git. If you haven't learned Git, you need it. You're a candidate for it because you've got all these different configurations, right?
Right, right. Well, I've used Git, but I'm like, well, I'm a lone developer out here, and I really don't need, you know.
Yeah, but it's for you. It's not just, it's not like you have multiple. I understand. I'm not a team. I don't need it, but you do. Because you have an effective team because you have multiple configurations. And you want to work locally or online. So with Git, you can synchronize them. That's what I do. I have my programming folder on multiple computers, and I just make sure that when I work on one, I push it up to Git, and then I can pull it on another computer, and I have everything I was working on. It also, here's the really good thing you're going to love, lets you roll back very easily. So if you screw things up, you can go back in time. And that's very, very handy. Somebody's mentioning Docker. Yeah. It's true that you could use a VM or Docker to do this as well. A lot of people use Docker containers on their Mac. They might have 5 Docker containers. And you could then synchronize the Docker containers. That would be another way to do
it. Right. Well, I was actually looking at doing that. I was going to actually do a local Ubuntu install under a VM. And then just,
let VM would work too. Yeah, Docker's a little lighter weight than a virtual machine, but it's the same idea.
Right, but the only thing about it is we're out here on the sticks, and, at maximum speed that you can basically is DSL 6 megabits. So,
well, that would argue for not using DigitalOcean. That would actually argue for using it locally with Docker. Because then you don't have to worry about getting online. You just launch a different Docker instance, and now you're working with Foundation 4 or whatever.
Right. So that's an idea.
Yeah, and Docker makes that very, very easy to do that. Hey, I got to run. Nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And keep up the good work. And I love your positive attitude.
Thank you. And feel better,
thank
John.
You very much.
I hate that flu. Oh. Man, I hate that.
Thing. Oh, thank you. Man.
You remind me. I got to go get my shot.
Oh, yeah. In the bone.
In the bone. Thank you, John. See ya.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.